Download, poet and activist Luis Rodriguez, former talk soup host John Henson, and local manufacturing entrepreneur Courtney Wright. Now, here's your host, a man who bought new deodorant, Justin Kaufman.
That's right. I'm sporting a Mountain Breeze now. I hope you like it. It's very rustic. Pine, even. But as you were listening yesterday, the fresh smell, it's too much like my kitty litter. It's got to change. It's a lifestyle change. And I'm excited about it. It's a, you know, when you change the scent, you know, I feel like perhaps this is a new chapter. Right? You change a deodorant or perfume and you're like, hey, I'm a new guy. Maybe I'll start playing handball. Or maybe I'll start chopping down trees. Or doing something more rustic. Wearing more Aztec sweaters. You know, with the sort of turquoise, yellow triangle patterns. Hey, it's all open right now. Because I've changed my deodorant. Life's looking up. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We have a great show lined up tonight. An old friend of mine is in town, Los Angeles, the former poet laureate of Los Angeles from 2014 to 2016. Luis Rodriguez will be in studio tonight to talk about his life, his career. What a tremendous, tremendous life. From a kid in East LA who in the late 60s and 70s fell into gangs, prison time, battled addiction, heroin, other sources, found himself using art, graffiti art first, and then murals to find a way out. Words came later, poetry. He wrote a memoir, two memoirs. He won a ton of awards, Carl Sandburg Award, came to Chicago, was one of the founders of the slam poet movement here in Chicago. Moved on back to East L.A. where he set up a coffee shop and a bookstore to help teenagers have alternatives so they don't get into gangs. And then he continues his work, and now he's back in Chicago this week for the Poetry Block Party, which is down in Pilsen. We talked to Kenya last week. She's performing at it, and he will be there as well. So he will be my guest tonight at the big table. We'll talk about art, writing, and living life. So that's coming up. The 8 o'clock hour. Tonight, the download in Chicago Business. Tuesdays, we do it every Tuesdays. Courtney Wright's in studio. Gemini Build It is the company that she... It was Gemini Molding. Essentially, we're going to talk about manufacturing. Courtney bought a company, an Elgin-based company, that possibly could have gone out of business. And she's resurrected and re-energized the business to really be on a crusade to make manufacturing cool. We'll talk about Gemini, we'll talk about entrepreneurship and instead of a startup, we've had a lot of startup businesses. We'll talk about what goes into purchasing an existing business. That'll be our conversation tonight, download on Chicago Business. Coming up at 9 o'clock hour, John Henson's going to join us, the former host of Talk Soup on E! Also Wipeout, one of my favorite game shows of all time. I guess that's because at the time I had like a five-year-old. So that the one thing he loved was Wipeout. So I know a lot about Wipeout. And I'd always see John doing the, ooh, that looks like it hurts. So great to have John on the show tonight talking about his new game show, Eyewitness. But we'll talk about his career and essentially, you know, evolving into the quintessential game show host. Talk about that coming up. Sam Panionovich is going to join us to talk about Beanball. Cubs Sox today, but also a story that isn't getting as much attention because of the Crosstown Classic and because we've moved on, but the idea of Derrick Rose playing alongside LeBron James for dominance in the Eastern Conference. That is a head-scratcher, man. Just blink 5 years ago and think if that was going to happen. To go from what was considered a max payout year for Derrick Rose to take the veteran minimum $2 million to play alongside LeBron James in Cleveland. We'll talk with Sam Panionovich about what we need to do as Chicago Bulls fans to cope. We need some coping mechanisms because if that goes well in any form, that's insult to injury here in Chicago. And we'll play the worst tonight. Mars Timms will be in studio. So we got a lot to do tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We will do the carryout. Stay with us. No, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. Even if you don't agree, it's nice to see that the Senate is playing by the rules for a change. A procedural vote moves Trump care to debate. I mean, usually that vote is a no-brainer, but it's so contentious right now that the Senate President, Vice President Mike Pence, had to break the tie just to argue this bill on the floor. Also, what bill are we talking about here? The House bill? The new Senate bill? A bill to make Thursday's Twitter free? What? Senator McCain was ushered to Washington in the midst of brain cancer treatment to vote, which is somewhat ironic that he's casting a vote that could take away health care for millions while he's currently using said health care, but that's beside the point. So now what? Well, besides the flurry of tweets from people targeting every senator with the, quote, never forget, insert state here. I saw so many of those today. Never forget, Ohio. Okay. All right, what's next? Well, they debate. And I, for one, can't wait to see what tricks are pulled to make sure that doesn't happen. Because you know that's next. Well, at least the healthcare vote took the Boy Scout speech off the front page. What was that? The president made a strange, goofy, and somewhat offensive speech to 30,000 Boy Scouts. And today the Scouts had to put out a statement defending the organization. And many have said that they're going to pull their kids out of the organization because of this rambling speech. I wouldn't worry about it, though. The same thing happened to FDR when he spoke to the Boy Scouts. Oh, it didn't? Because FDR didn't swear, talk about his political opponent, and hint at sexy yacht parties in the south of France? He talked about tying knots and helping old ladies cross the street? Boring. Never happened. This 2017, not your dad's Boy Scouts. President Trump did have a chance today to talk smack about his own Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. It's the latest to be out of favor in the White House, mostly because the president's mad that he recused himself over Russia. Why? Well, it's a sign of weakness to recuse yourself, I guess. Or is it the president saying that he wants the attorney general, who runs the Justice Department, to put the president first, law second? Might I remind the entire country that it is July, that we just finished 6 months of the Trump administration? The NSA head's out, the FBI director's out, the communications director's out, the Secretary of State's taking time off. The top advisor's been relegated to the bench, and now it looks like the attorney general's being pushed out. Do we still have the agriculture secretary? Oh, good. Sonny Perdue's still there. I don't know if I could live in a country without Sonny Perdue as the agriculture secretary. Tomorrow, Springfield's back in the special session where everyone just chills out and shares their summer vacation stories, maybe show off their new tattoos. Seriously, there is nothing to do because it's all a ruse to get the Democrats to send the school funding bill to Governor Rauner so they can veto the Chicago part. Senate President Cullerton says he won't send the bill till he has a chance to sit down with Rauner to explain why this bill is misunderstood. And Rauner says, nope. And then he tried to write on Cullerton's face with the veto pen. So to refresh, Rauner wants to veto the pension payments in this bill, calling it a sneaky bailout for Chicago schools. Madigan and Cullerton say this is a fair deal for the biggest school district in the state, and they don't want to have it vetoed over partisan politics. Rauner's play is to tour state school districts, not Chicago, and tell them that they will get all the Chicago money if he can veto. Democrats' move was to not send the bill to Rauner, to make all the school districts sweat about whether or not the doors will open come early August. So a regular old Tuesday in Illinois, eh? In weather, best day yet, huh? I mean, right. Think about it. This is the best weather day of 2017. Beauty. Nothing wrong with today. In sports, the Cubs got a win in a very strange game at Wrigley. They beat the Sox 7-2. This game had it all. Strikeouts, walks, an infield fly rule, tons of stolen bases, a hits batsman, retaliation for hit batsmen, coaches and umpires constantly arguing, and ooh, an ejection. Chris Bryant thrown out of the game for tossing, for arguing a called third strike. How do you kick Chris Bryant out of the Crosstown Classic? That ump needs to be fined, first off. I don't know what Chris Bryant said, but come on, it's Chris Bryant. It's the Crosstown Classic. People paid big money to see that game. And secondly, it was a ball. So, and we came pretty close to a Crosstown brawl, which is what we were all secretly hoping for. and a little stare down between Lackey and Abreu after Abreu was hit by a pitch. And then the Sox put in a guy who threw it Hap, and it all simmered, but it didn't boil. Oh, that's too bad. Was I the only one hoping for fisticuffs? Or at least just Abreu charging the mound and pounding on Big Country, John Lackey? Just everyone kind of turn their head for a second, let that one happen? Seriously, Lackey hit four White Sox today. I think both the Cubs and the Sox would have turned around for like 10 seconds. Nothing to see here. Let Abreu get a couple shots in. Carlos Rodon, the starting pitcher for the White Sox, had a rough start again. His second in a row and a third bad start out of the four he's had this year. This has to be somewhat unsettling for Sox brass, although he did strike out 11, but in a jam every one of the four innings that he pitched. Four innings. Rodon needs to step up. He's got to be an ace here because he continues to struggle, and that doesn't bode well for the future. I don't know. At this point, I feel like it could be plausible to ship him at the deadline for prospects. After all, it's been a week since the prospect monster has been fed. Yum, 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 yum. Carlos Rodon for maybe a backup catcher and a couple of minor leaguers. Doesn't matter. Yum, 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 yum. Chicken nuggets. Yum, 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 yum. Oh, it's official. The Cavs have signed Derrick Rose to a one-year deal, vet minimum. So after all that talk about max contracts in the summer of 2017, Rose settles for $2.1 million after getting paid $20 million last year. But he gets a chance to play for a contender in LeBron James in Cleveland. And if that doesn't make your stomach turn, Chicago, who cares about the knee surgeries? D. Rose was the antithesis of the flashy LeBron James. What a difference a couple years makes. LeBron and D. Rose are in Cleveland, and we have Dwayne Wade. Just think about that. The Bears get set to report to training camp tomorrow. Camp starts on Thursday, so tomorrow's the day that everybody shows up in their Escalades, their cool Humvee race cars, or you know, their Toyota Excel, because they're humble. Anyway, that's tomorrow. And finally tonight, the best NFL story today surrounds wide receiver for the Dallas Cowboys, a guy named Lucky Whitehead. Did you see the story? The Cowboys cut him after word came out that he missed a court appearance for shoplifting in Virginia. But the rub was that it wasn't him. So, yep, someone said they were Lucky Whitehead when he was arrested, and the Virginia police were like, well, how do you spell that? So he was nowhere near that crime, yet the Cowboys are sticking to their guns, cutting him for bad judgment this offseason. What? What the? I zero tolerance in the NFL. I mean, if you are a third-string receiver misidentified for a crime, there is no room for you. Now, if you're a first-string running back who has been being investigated for a second domestic abuse charge, you deserve the benefit of the doubt. I think you do. Let's not jump to conclusions. Everyone gets a second chance. Now clean out your locker, Lucky, if that's your real name. Break. That's the carryout for July 25th, 2017. Hey, for every charbroiled chicken sandwich ordered tonight, we're giving away a Crosstown bobblehead. Yep, I know it's Mark DeRosa, but we had him left over. Just put a goatee on it. Whoa, it's Chris Bryant. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with Courtney Wright in the Download in Chicago Business. 8 o'clock, Luis Rodriguez joins us at the big table. And at 9 o'clock, John Henson, the former host of Talk Soup on E. We'll be on the Download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I'm like you, my friend. I was hoping for a little Donnybrook on the north side today as the beanballs were flying.
There are a couple extra stares.
3-1 inning. Yeah, who won that competition? The menacing stare down.
I know, right? I was hoping for more.
I'm looking at you.
The only thing, as a Sox fan,
my bat at you.
Both of us, you know, when they hit Abreu, when Lackey hit Abreu, I was like, meh. Yeah. And then they hit Davidson, meh. And then they hit Moncada. I'm like, well, don't, no. That's the future. That's the only reason we're watching right now.
Yes.
This kid gets hit right in the wrist. And you're like, no, don't, no. Oh, not him. Nobody but him.
Well, where's Renteria during all this?
Yeah, I know.
Because I'm only watching out of the corner of my eye, so I didn't.
He came out after the third one to be like, is there a warning? Like, he was going for Little League rules, where he's like, is the pitcher out? Does he go to shortstop now?
He's a big league guy, you know. He's got a little bit more control than that.
Exactly. I remember it reminded me, I had a kid in Little League who was like the best pitcher of all time. He's so fast, and we were 8 years old, 9 years old. But the problem was that he was wild. So every third kid he hit, you know? And so I remember one time he was so fast, he was faster than everybody else, but when he hit the kid, it would hurt, you know? And I remember a grandma standing up being like, he needs to get out of the game. Like he just flipped out at everybody. It's, we all had to let grandma yell at the pitcher,
let
the 8-year-old pitcher. So.
Let it out.
That's what I was hoping Rick Renteria was going to do for
that. It's business time.
It is time for the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. Tonight we talk manufacturing, or maybe more accurate, saving manufacturing jobs in Illinois. That's what my guest did tonight when she bought Gemini Molding, a framing company in Elgin. The owner was retiring, and instead of shutting down the business, Courtney Wright doubled down on the business. She renamed the company Gemini Builds It, added more employees, and has re-energized the company in their 50,000-square-foot manufacturing center. Courtney Wright is a local entrepreneur who was the founder of CDW Merchants, a design company that did window and store displays for high-end clients like Kate Spade and Club Monaco. In 2016, she sold that business and jumped into the framing and acrylics business, which is where she is today. We'll talk about what she's learned from that business right now. Courtney Wright, my guest in studio on the Download in Chicago Business. Courtney, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
So talk about the mood. Let's first talk about this, because I as I kind of teed this up before the news, the idea, I've had a lot of startup entrepreneurs on this program, but I haven't had too many who have acquired businesses. What was the impetus to acquire Gemini Molding?
Well, I did a startup, and that was didn't kill me. It was a successful one. It aged me more than the 10 years I had it, I would say. But when I went out after having a successful sale and knew that entrepreneurship was something I wanted to go back into, the idea was, do I start again and start something from scratch, or do I buy something that's got some movement and some sales, re-energize that, change the culture, and grow it more quickly than starting from dollar one? And at least for now, I decided that to buy a series of companies was the sort of next phase of my career and something that I hadn't done. Mm-hmm. So I looked and created a pipeline. And as it turns out, Gemini Molding at the time was a 10-year supplier to CDW Merchants.
And so you had a relationship with them already.
Yeah, we did for 10 years. In fact, the very first order I sold at CDW Merchants, my supplier said they couldn't do it. And I said, well, too bad. I already took the order. And I figured out, I met these guys and they did it. And I had a really long run of successful transactions with them. So I knew more or less what I was getting into.
I mean, for you, I mean, to go from a CDW Merchants, which was a design company, it was window displays and really high-end work, and go into framing and acrylics. Are they similar in nature? I mean, as an owner of CDW Merchants and Gemini, is it a natural transition?
Well, there are some things about business that are similar. You know, if you have one person, you have people problems, so to speak. So people is really at the core of any business, I think, and customers probably second to that. The primary difference is, one, I worked a lot in China with CDW Merchants, and we bought and resold things that we designed. Here, we produce. So we buy raw materials, and we actually convert them, create them, assemble them from scratch, all along custom displays, framing, and acrylic fabrication. There are some skills that I have that translate pretty easily. I'm a sales and marketer, and that's the part I handle.
Yeah.
They don't let me near the saws or any of the tools. In fact, one of my guys always says to me, you own one of those machines, and I laugh and say, okay, what can it do? So as long as it can make pretty stuff, I think I can sell it. What's very different is acquiring talent, you know, that manufactures.
Yeah, right.
In Chicagoland, where unemployment is so low. Has been a different recruiting skill.
Interesting. I mean, because that would be part of the work of owning a manufacturing business is trying to not only acquire that talent, but identify that talent, because it is a different sort of skill set. You may be great at sales and marketing, but understanding who's good at actually producing the product, that's another story.
It's an art. What our guys do is absolutely incredible. You know, they're obviously engineering minded people that work in acrylic and wood, but the passion and the understanding of what they bring to it really makes me so passionate about bringing manufacturing back to this country, because this kind of work is you know, quite honestly, undervalued. You know, a lot of our customers don't want to pay the prices that it costs to have, you know, skilled manufacturers with benefits working in Chicago, raising a family. And that's really a point of difference for us is we're a lot faster because we are, you know, locally made. We think we're a lot more creative than things you'll find overseas. We can react on the fly because, you know, I can walk in the back and say, put this molding on or that molding. But really, you know, everybody in our country has been told, go to college, go to college, get a 4-year degree, get in a lot of debt, and then you can get a job. Nobody says grow up and become a woodwork craftsman. Nobody says, you know, come work in acrylic. And that's what I'm really trying to promote for a certain set of people that want to be busy during the day and want to be creative and crafting things from hand. We've got an awesome story.
Is your main competition, when you're talking about customers in design and acrylics and molding, is it overseas production? Is that the idea that people can say, I'm going to go online and I'll get something from China and that'll be cheaper or different or quicker, or it's just more in my comfort zone than actually going to the locals?
Yeah, I mean, you know, China is in our industry for real. That's a big part of the competition. Not as fast as what we can do, but, you know, a third the price. Where we have success is Gemini Molding bought a company that was an acrylic fabricator a decade or so ago and really specialized in the museum trade, where aesthetics, quality, bubble-free, seam-free, all these kind of words that are intrinsic to the museum space that a museum curator says, I only need the best, that's the place they played in. So a China solution isn't going to work for them because you can't stick your, you know, Monet painting behind something that's got all right. these little cracks and bubbles in it. So the work we do for the right audience is really, you know, we have limited competition. But if you want to just buy, you know, an acrylic box, well, there's probably 1,000.
I was going to say that has to be one of the challenges of running a small business that is in Chicago that's in this industry, the acrylics industry, is you may have the market cornered on quality.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of customers that are like that may overlook bubbles and cracks and the things that you're mentioning too, because they're like, I just need it next day and I'll go online and whatever's the cheapest dollar
cheapest.
That I see that I'm going to do that. So, I mean, how do you as a company project and convey the fact that there is a difference, there is a quality difference right here in Chicago?
Well, that's really, I think, a big point of difference. The experience that our team brings to the table. We stock over 100 kinds of acrylic. Now, don't ask me to name them or tell you what they all do, but they all have a specific niche. One can retain scratches, and one is specific to UV light. And once you get into a conversation with our people and they ask more questions, you know, maybe that online solution isn't right for the particular thing that you want to put under it. So you may put your precious, you know, piece or artifact at risk because you're not understanding enough about what you're buying.
Mm-hmm.
It's really our job to educate our customers and develop the best solution that works for what they're trying to preserve and protect.
Was it hard for you to dive into something that was somewhat foreign, the idea of learning acrylics and what it means to have a quality product?
Well, for sure, it's been hard. Luckily, I've got
Did
a
Did you bring flashcards home?
yeah. Well, the acrylic was actually the most familiar part of the business in the wood to me because it's a lot of what I had bought prior. What was difficult for me is coming from a world, you know, we sold our company to a public company called Bunzel back in a couple years ago. And they, like us, were very fast-paced drivers, just run it down, hunt it down, grow the business at any cost and just keep going. Manufacturing, you got to kind of go at the pace of the people producing things until you get people believing that we can go faster, grow faster, do more.
Well, I want to talk about that. We'll take a quick break here. But when we come back, let's talk about the bigger issue for when you acquire a company, especially when you want to change, is the capital C change word, how you change the culture and the surrounding company. Gemini Builds It is the company. Courtney Wright is the owner. She's in studio tonight. It's a download on Chicago Business. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's a download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. In studio tonight, Courtney Wright. She's the owner of Gemini Builds It. It is a molding company, acrylics, printing, all sorts of things. You know, I mentioned it's funny because in the first segment here, we got really into the weeds. But the concept of, I mean, who is coming to you as customers when I say Gemini builds it, what are you providing?
Justin, we provide businesses with a series of things, you know, framing, acrylic pedestals, display cases, printing, gallery walls, things that can make their spaces, whether it's their restaurants, their hotels, their museum, their country club, office building, you know, residence hall, look better, you know, and really tell the story. You know, things like we had a story recently, you know, we sell a lot of Cubs related and framed and encapsulated paraphernalia. But a really favorite memory was somebody who brought their son's baseball from the pitch that was part of the World Series. And the son, you know, 9-year-old little boy, highlight of his entire life, says, "Dad, this is the best night of my entire life, but I want to have it on my wall." Well, nobody ever thinks about how you frame a baseball. And we were able to put the Cubs pennant, the Cubs picture, the signed autograph, the ball, all this into a custom created shadow box. And it's now on his bedroom wall and he kind of worships it every night. So it's really creating things that are special, that people want to preserve and protect some meaningful memory or make a space look really great.
For you, you acquired this company and you had just mentioned in the first segment that you had a business relationship with the company. When acquiring a company, what goes into that? What are the challenges that go into it? Because you have your own ideas of what you want to do, especially when it comes to manufacturing, maybe give it a little bit more of a style and a culture. What do you have to do to make that happen?
So one of my mentors told me that when you acquire a company, you have to go fast. And I don't think any of the 55 or so people that work there would say that I do anything slowly. But I think they were pretty surprised when about week two, I came in and gutted the place. And I did so really intentionally. I really wanted to signal that in order to change a culture, which is what we were going to embark on together, we really needed a fresh start. And so right down to the walls, we kind of got rid of everything, all the office furniture, every bit of art.
The design, everything that was in the building.
Everything was in the building. I said, we are going to clean this place from corner to corner, paint this place, redecorate it, and have ourselves a fresh start with a new logo, a new website, and a new identity. And they said, well, you know, it's a 40-year-old successful company. Why would we do that? And I said, exactly that. We need to question every single thing we're doing. The market is changing. Our customer base is changing. People's needs are changing. And if we don't change faster than them, we'll be out of business.
You had experience in being a startup. Why not start up in this business? Why acquire a company? Of course, there's institutional knowledge in there, but I mean, there is talent in this town and you could start your own
for sure
acrylics company.
Absolutely.
Printing company.
I certainly could do that. I think for me, you know, there's a lot of equipment and know-how and our people are absolutely the smartest and best at what they do. Completely believe that. We've got institutional knowledge that just, you know, we couldn't replace, not in the timeline of what I see growing the company. And really, the reality is, Justin, this is the starting company to something else that will be added on and tucked on and rolled on so that we get a company that's bigger, that has more capabilities, that will service our customers better and create a better opportunity for every single person that works there if they want it.
For you, I mean, you come in, there is a culture that's already in place. The first step is to clean it and change it and redesign the workspace. What else goes into re-energizing and motivating a company to look towards change?
Yeah, so one thing that we did was I said, you know, let's have a monthly town hall and we're going to get together and we're going to talk about everything from how we make money to who these new faces are you're seeing around the table. And I think people were ghostly white. And they said, I said, what's wrong? We're just talking about our sales. And in 7 years was the last company meeting, 7 years ago. So every 7 years, whether you needed it or not, you were going to hear how we were doing. And I said, no, we're going to do this every 7 days and every 4 weeks. We're going to sit down as a group. We're going to have, you know, whether it's a meal or some donuts or just some time to talk about the financials, the culture, our goals, how we're doing against things. And that was a big culture change. You know, the prior owner didn't believe in sharing information, and I totally believe that I'm not doing this alone.
What's the benefit for you as to share this information?
Well, the benefit is that I believe the more people know, the more they can do their job in a way that helps drive bottom line improvement and performance. They didn't know how we made money. They didn't know if we were making money, and they certainly didn't know what the sales of the company were. And I don't know that they all understand or really care about it, but certainly people, I've seen some incredible shining stars that are asking questions and they're engaged and saying, hey, I had these ideas, but the last guy wouldn't let me do them. And I said, bring them on. Recycle all your old ideas. They're all good as far as I'm concerned.
You know, you are running a business and, yeah, and the idea is the bottom line, and you've already had success with your startup with CDW Merchants. I mean, how much of do you have to protect, or not protect is not the right word, how much do you have to drive that home that this is a business? At the end of the day, we are trying to make money. The culture is important and the motivation of the employees is important, but at the end of the day, it's about the bottom line.
Well, I think that they're hearing a lot about that. You know, we have decided to invest a lot, whether that's in people. We bought a printing company back in December, so that really we became a one-stop shop for anything that was needed. And people now need to say, look, we've invested a lot, from everything from a facelift to new people to new talent, new, you know, pieces of equipment. Now it's time to sell stuff and make money. And that's everyone's up for the challenge. They just need to know what's the goal, what are the measurements, and how are we getting there? And that's really what I need to spend more time with them, helping them see the vision that I see, because I know we can get there.
Manufacturing has been a touch point, not just here in the state of Illinois, but the country. We talked a lot about it. You know, a lot of what I read about you today is about trying to make manufacturing cool. I know that's kind of a strange sentence, but the idea of moving manufacturing to what we know about it, the way that it's sort of been couched, to a different type of company, a different sort of, I guess, gloss to it. How do you do that? How do you get behavioral changes, not just for the people that work there, but the consumers, that manufacturing is a different kind of industry?
Well, I think you really have to look at all your people. So, you know, one thing I did, which was really so pleasurable for me, is ride with our delivery truck drivers. You know, we've got a fleet of 10 trucks and 10 drivers that drive around the Midwest delivering our products. And I really got to see, first of all, I think it's one of the hardest jobs we have in our business, because they're hauling all of this glass and acrylic and heavy oversized frames. And I saw them see 24 customers a day and what they go through to make sure everything's ticked and tied and delivered accurately. And all of a sudden they started showing up and saying, hey, did you see our old logo was on this? And I don't have the right T-shirt and I need my new uniform. And now they're showing up. Well, I've got 300 deliveries happening a week. If that experience is better for our clients, it's way better than me, you know, saying something to two customers a week. So it really starts at the ground up, you know, working with the people, going in the back, understanding what they're doing, and having our management team really be part of it, which is new. They you know, kind of were corner office people before. They sat in the front, and now everybody's sort of in the back, working together, learning everyone's job, so we can each show each other how to do it better.
How important is it, last question, just about being a Chicago-based business? I mean, to be an Elgin, to do manufacturing and framing and acrylics and molding here in the Midwest. It can be done anywhere, as we just talked about. Your competition is overseas. How important is it to be known as a Chicago-area business?
Well, I think it's really important. I think that all of the big customers in Chicago and big clients should feel really vested in investing in our own economy. I certainly have a passion for it, as somebody who's lived here for 30-something years, that if we don't spend money in this town, you know, Wisconsin's being very aggressive and relocating a lot of manufacturers. What's going to be left if we don't support our own people in our own town and our own communities? We can put our money anywhere. But to me, there's a real, at this sort of midpoint in my life, a real passion and excitement about doing it in my hometown and doing it with people that are so good. And I know we can have something really successful.
Courtney Wright is the owner and operator of Gemini Builds It, a framing company based in Elgin, where they have their 50,000 square feet manufacturing center. She acquired that company just a year ago. I mean, just in, yeah, within a year. Courtney, thanks so much for being my guest tonight and sharing your story here in Chicago on the Download on Chicago Business.
Justin, thank you. And don't forget to mention WGN for 25% off your Cubs printing.
It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Crawford. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, Sam Panionovich will be here. We'll talk about the Crosstown Classic. Let's talk about Derrick Rose going to the Cleveland Cavaliers to play alongside LeBron James. I feel like I'm going to get my Pepto-Bismol on that one. If that goes well, that's going to be a heart. That's going to be heartburn for the Chicago Bulls and Chicago Bulls fans watching homegrown Derrick Rose dominate the Eastern Conference. We'll see about that. Also coming up, John Henson. He's the former host of Talk Soup on E. He's got a new game show called Eyewitness. He'll join us in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is a writer, novelist, critic, columnist, politician, and former poet laureate. Luis Rodriguez has lived a full life of struggle, gangs, addiction, jail, heartbreak. But the former Chicagoan turned to art and the written word to find his true calling. Rodriguez is the award-winning author of Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., and the follow-up sequel memoir, It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing, plus several more titles. He has dedicated his life to being a voice for the voiceless, whether that means setting up a bookstore and cafe in San Fernando Valley to give teenagers other options than gangs, or running for governor of California as a member of the Green Party. Rodriguez may be known for his work in L.A., but the Chicano writer made his name right here in Chicago as both a reporter and a poet, moving here in 1985 and living here throughout the 90s. He's back in town for the Poetry Block Party this weekend, put on by the Chicago Poetry Foundation and the National Museum of Mexican Art. That'll be this weekend in Pilsen, and it is my pleasure to welcome Luis Rodriguez to the big table tonight. Luis, great to see you.
You know what? It's wonderful to be back here. You know, great Chicago, great weather. Can't beat it.
You came at the right time, right?
Yeah.
Good to see you. You know, I mentioned, you know, you have such success in Los Angeles, but I know you as a Chicagoan. I mean, yeah. you were a big part of the slam poetry scene here in the 80s and 90s.
When I was born, I was in the middle of it. I can't say that I did anything more than just participate and take. But what we did do is create Theatrucha Press to publish some of the best, including Patricia Smith and David Hernandez and Carlos Cumpian, some of the Lisa Buscana, we you know, Tony Fitzpatrick. We've published a lot of great people, and now we're a national press. We're right. All over now. Yeah.
I mean, do you think about those days? I mean, do you long for those days back in Chicago?
Well, you know, they were exciting. They were vibrant. Chicago was a literary town unlike any other city. You know, I mean, it was coming from the ground up. It wasn't, and I don't have no problem with academia, but it wasn't academia. It was the ground up, and it was all these voices, the diversity of voices is what made the Chicago scene so powerful.
For you, I mean, you had such success with your memoirs. I mean, there has been. But like I said, Chicago knows you as a poet and knows you as also, I mean, you wore so many different hats. You were a reporter at one point for WMAQ.
Yeah.
What is it like to come back to Chicago? I mean, for you to have roots now in Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley and other places, what's it like to come back and walk the streets of Chicago?
Well, you know, Chicago and L.A., they're so different, but they do have a similarity. They were the two most industrialized cities in the country. And when they got hit with the deindustrialization, the post-industrial world that we're in now, they suffered the most. And you can see it in the streets. You can see it when the jobs were pulled out. You can see it when the steel mills went down, the meat packing, the same thing in L.A. So the ghettos and barrios of L.A. were infected, like South Central, East L.A., just like the South Side and the near North Side, all these neighborhoods that were just inundated with unemployment, no jobs. And guess what? Guns and drugs came in at the same time in the 80s. And these communities were like the best places to do them because they had gangs. They had kids that can organize. That people don't realize that the start of it was just nothing to do. And then somebody making sure they had enough guns and drugs to make something. So now we're seeing the legacy of it. All these lost kids, a lot of people dead. I think there's a lot of hope. But I've seen too many people die here in Chicago. I was working with all these kids, especially during the worst time. Actually, Chicago is not the worst time in violence. It was in the 90s.
Not right now. You're saying the 90s.
Yeah, it was actually worse than the 90s. And we were working with all the gangs that we could up and down the city. We had like 12 communities we were working with. We had a Crease the Peace Network. We had the Youth Struggling for Survival organization. We were working, changing things. But we couldn't get the support. You know what I mean? We couldn't get the money, the support, the fund. We worked with people like Build and worked with great groups, but it wasn't coming in, and I think that's what was missing here. They didn't back up the peace work.
Well, it sounds familiar. I mean, it sounds a lot of the struggles that we hear in 2017.
Same thing, man. And then you can tell now it's really gotten out of hand. You can tell that now kids are getting a little bit numb from it. They're seeing so much violence that there doesn't seem to be a way out, and I think there is a way out, but the only way to address it is poverty. You gotta go to the root of it. You know, no matter what you do to band-aid it, fix it, you know, try to move it around, it ain't gonna work until you get to the very root. The poverty in the city, which again, deindustrialization played a big role. How we're gonna get jobs in the new technology? Mm-hmm. How we're gonna change the resources to something that can encompass everybody?
Well, you know, as I bill you as a writer and a poet, a lot of your poetry has been about social injustice. It's been about your experience. Yeah. Let's start there. I mean, have spent a lot of your adult life being someone who's been an activist and a voice for the voiceless, and a teacher, and an, I don't know what the word would be, but someone who intervenes. Meaning you have spent a lot of your life trying to get kids who are in the same situation you were in L.A. to not make the choice to get into gangs or to look at other options.
You know what? Because I got mentored. People came and saw something in me. One or two people. One didn't take a lot, but enough to say, we're going to work with this kid. He was hungry and angry enough, and I was. I was angry about the injustice, but I was also hungry for new things. I came out of the poorest neighborhood in L.A. County. There was nothing going on. I was on heroin. I was in the streets. I was homeless. I was in and out of jails and juvenile hall. Somebody plucked me out of that and told me there is life worth living. There really is a consciousness and an understanding you can have. Social justice.
Art, right?
Through art. I painted 8 murals. Never got trained. They gave me opportunity to paint murals. I started playing music. I started doing everything. But writing's what stuck. Writing, I loved to read. Even when I was homeless in the streets of downtown L.A., I would go to the libraries and read books after books after books. It changed my life. And then made me think, maybe I could do it. It's hard to imagine that because when you're in the streets, but I did. There was a dream that I went for, and I had people who helped me every step of the way. But I had to walk through those doors. All people can do is open a door.
Right.
If you don't walk through them, it's on you, you know.
When you talk to kids, even today, I mean, today you're in Chicago, you're talking to kids on the West Side. Yeah. I mean, is that the story that you tell? Do you try to connect with them by telling your personal story?
That's the best way. You know, the kids, they have a BS meter. They know you're BS, and they know you're... So they look at me, I look like a regular schmo. You know, I look like the uncle, that, you know, I look like the janitor.
Uncle Luis is here.
I don't look like no hardcore gangster. I look like a regular schmo, but then I tell my story, and they're like, riveted. And because I'm also telling them, listen, you got to own your life. I turned my life over to guns, drugs, and gangs. Turned it over. Didn't have nothing for me. And I didn't care if I died. I could stand in the street corner, come kill me. I did everything I could to die, and it wasn't happening. These kids have to want to live. And I know many of them feel the same way. It's like the funeral is the best day anybody could ever have. That's what they think. You know what I'm saying? What, people fall crying, mothers crying, the pop shows up whenever he shows up in your life. He shows up at your funeral. People think that must be the best day of one's life. They have to dream beyond that. They have to plan.
How do you do it? I mean, Luis, how do you, for you mentioned the thing, I mean, if you're talking about poverty and there's no place to go, how do you convince kids that it's not going to be their best day, day of their life?
The richness is inside of them. The richness is in the art and the passion, the genius they're already carry. That's what you got to convince them. Then nobody's ever told them that. You got genius. I had genius I didn't know. I could be an artist. I could be a writer. Of course, I had to get the discipline and get up and gumption to get up and do it, but anybody can do that. I think kids need to know there's a genius, and only you can fill that place that you were meant to do. Do that life, that passion that you care about, that art, that creativity, that imagination. Go there. You know, it changes people's lives, and that's the direction I'd like to get them to see that it's possible.
I have so many questions about, you know, when you in your life, how when you intervene and you try to get kids to look in impoverished neighborhoods to look somewhere else besides gangs, you know, I mean, it feels like it's a lost cause. And I don't mean that in any sort of disrespectful way. That's why I was tripped up on even saying it that way. But the idea that it's a very difficult proposition for you to come in, say, I'm with this organization. I can help you. I'm going to open this door. Have you thought about art? Have you thought about painting? I could see them quickly being like, no, I haven't, and leave me alone.
Yeah, and you know what? That's where I want to be. The lost causes are the only causes worth fighting. You understand? The ones that nobody else wants to do anymore. I'm right there. I've been going to prisons for 37 years. I'm still going to maximum security prisons. Now I'm still going an hour from my house. Lifers, why would I care about them? They're not going anywhere. But guess what? They're human beings. They got to be transformed, and also they got to help transform others. I feel it's worth it. All the lost causes, that's where I'm at. I went to Cabrini Green when no Mexican would show up in Cabrini Green. I was there. People were saying, what are you doing here? I'm here working with the youth. Okay. You know, they were okay. But they first like, what's wrong with you? You know, I would go in places that nobody else would go, the places that nobody wanted to be at, because they're human beings, and each one of them was worth fighting for. And yeah, you know, as you know, this work, you lose a lot of people. I lost a lot of leaders. People killed, people dying, but we saved many more. I've seen gang leaders who are now graduating from DePaul University with four kids. He's going to be a teacher. Another one got shot three times just walking out of my house in the youth gathering I had in Logan Square. He got shot three times. He survived. Now he got his master's. He's trying to help people. I've seen some of these kids that in any other occasion, they would have been completely forgotten. I know it's possible, but it isn't easy. It's hard work. Not anybody can do that.
Luis Rodriguez in studio, the former poet laureate of Los Angeles, writer, author, his memoir, one of the famous, I mean, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. That memoir won a Carl Sandburg Award. I mean, you've won so many awards over your time, and you're going to be at the Poetry Block Party put on by the Chicago Poetry Foundation, the National Museum of Mexican Art, this weekend in Pilsen. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation at the big table with Luis Rodriguez. Stay with us. Nothing better than a promo that says, listen, today at 1, when it's 7, that's 8:30 at night. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Luis Rodriguez is my guest in studio at the big table, the award-winning author, writer, poet, activist, who is right now living in the Los Angeles area, but is known to us as a longtime Chicagoan. His award-winning memoir, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., is tremendous. And also, he's going to be at the Poetry Block Party put on by the Chicago Poetry Foundation and the National Museum of Mexican Art this weekend in Pilsen. You know, we were talking about your activism and your work with youth, really based on your story, your personal story of how you overcame your youth, because you had a very tumultuous start to your life, born in a rough neighborhood, got into gangs, drugs, prison. There was some jail time in there. Yeah. I mean, you really, when we talk about talk to talk and trying to get gang members to rethink their lives, you can tell your own story.
Yeah, and I'm pretty fortunate. I know it. I'm blessed compared to many people. But, you know, it's one of those things is when you survive all that, you have that survival thing where why me and not my homies, you know. And so I decided not to question it. It's a mystery. I'm here. I better do some good with what I've been given. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I survived whatever everybody went through. I'm here, and I got to give back. And I got to teach. I got to show people. But I can't judge people. I can't knock them down. I can't just go plowing through there. I got to connect with people. I got to find out what their story is, connect with my story, let them know that there is a possibility that that story doesn't have to end in a bad way if they can only see them.
I mean, story has to plays a huge role in your life, your own personal story, what stories you write. Story and storylines and narrative. I mean, there seems to be threads throughout, not just the work you put on the page, but your life.
I didn't know I had a story. Nobody does. We all think our story doesn't matter. You talk to people, it's no big deal. They're like, you know what? Everybody's got one, but we're not told. The stories we get are generally people with some money and maybe some power. You don't get the stories of the poor guys in the corner, the people that were working in these industries and now no longer work there. And I don't care what race is, everybody's going through that story. And maybe some people think, well, I'm for Trump and I'm for this person. It doesn't really matter. To me, the common thing is we're all in the Titanic sinking here, and we better figure out a way to not go down with the ship. So I think that's where we're at, where all of us, racial boundaries, who cares, can come together and say, you know what, we're in the same boat. What can we do as strategically and unified as poor people, as people that don't got much going on, to change things? Because they're already writing off poor people. You know, the president says, I'll never have poor people in my cabinet. Dude, I bet you some of these people, some of those kids I talked to today, if they were running Congress right now, they would do a better job than the people there. I'm convinced.
Well, I mean, it seems, and you mentioned it, just about poverty, and you have talked at length in your work, but also in your activism about inequality. I mean, you ran for governor of California on the idea of inequality.
Yeah.
You know, how we talked about your life and even being here in Chicago in the 80s and the 90s and what you're doing now in the Los Angeles area in 2017. Is it getting worse? Is it the same? I mean, you kind of talked about violence. It was worse in the 90s. What about inequality? What about poverty?
Well, as you know, the inequality gap is larger than ever it's been. And it's getting more. I mean, people are taking advantage of the rest of us. Wealth gets transferred. It's not just somebody making money on the side. They're making money off people who aren't making money. You know what I'm saying? And what happened in the mortgage financial crisis in 2008 is wealth got transferred again. We were talking about big developers, mostly out of New York, picking up all that money. Now they're developing major cities like Chicago and And L.A., I'm not against New Yorkers. Poor New Yorkers are suffering. You know, I'm against the people that use that a terrible crisis to benefit themselves. And now they're running roughshod. So I think we have to challenge some sacred cows. We got to say we can't give up on people's health and people's well-being. We can't give up on their lives. These are good people. All these people in these neighborhoods, even those poor, violent neighborhoods, are good, decent people. They need a chance to live. They need resources. They need tools. They need skills. They need to be helped.
Does it make your job harder when you're trying to intervene with a kid who's 16 years old who's making a choice to get into gangs, and you're saying there's a better life out there when there possibly isn't?
Well, here's the thing. I always felt that even with poverty, there's richness in people's spirit, richness in people's imagination. And I try to tell them, you still got something. You may not have material power or material richness, and I'm not saying you shouldn't have those things. I'm just saying you still got something. I did it in many ways because I went imagination. I went to mural painting. I went to music. I went to writing. I went anywhere. I was so hungry for something new, and all I needed was somebody to show me I could do this, because without those people, I would never have known. You can do this. You can write. You can do murals. Really? You know, I was so hungry for it, I went for everything I could. A lot of these kids are like that. And it isn't easy. I've had kids walk away from me. I've had kids say, well, you know, but it's okay. I'm still there. I'm still hanging in there, just so that they know at least there's some adults that won't. Because, you know, kids test you. Because they don't want to emotionally invest in you if you're not going to stick around.
Yeah, right.
So they're already like getting rid of you. Most people leave. I'm still hanging around. I'm still there. The next morning I come in. It's not like I don't get mad. You know, they treat you badly, okay. But I'm still there. And that's what they need to see more of. They don't see enough of that.
When you have been intervening in your life, and you do this through all of the groups that you've worked with and the activism that you've done in your career, you talked about, you know, kids trying to test you.
Yeah.
Do you still see it that way? Do you still see in 2017, are the tests more rigid? Are the kids saying, you know what, old man, I don't need you around me? Is it the same arguments that are made in the 80s and 90s when you're doing this? Are they comparable to the way kids act today?
You know what? The same arguments I made. I would tell these guys, drop dead. I don't want to invest in them, because they will all walk away. And one or two of them didn't. Same arguments I gave them. You old dude, what do you know? You don't know what I've been through. You don't know me. That whole thing, I was doing it when I was 16, 17. So these kids are doing that. I remember one time I went to a big prison in North Carolina, all African-Americans, murderers at the top row. I said, I want to talk to them. So they said that this guy wrote Always Running was coming, so all these guys were waiting for me. I show up again. I look like a regular schmo. They started laughing, all these guys, but I didn't care. I walked up. You know, respectfully went up to the podium. Once I told my story, once I started talking, once I read some of these poems, by the time I got through, they gave me a standing ovation. Because people are still looking for an authentic, genuine thing. They see it when they see it. They know it when it's there, and it's hardly ever there. But when they see it, I find a lot of these kids, like, they want to gravitate towards something that's real for them.
Luis Rodriguez is my guest tonight, the former poet laureate of Los Angeles, author, poet, writer, I mean, all sorts of mural painter. We put that in there. Activist.
Slam activist, whatever you want to call it.
He is going to be at the Poetry Block Party put on by the Chicago Poetry Foundation, the National Museum of Mexican Art, this weekend in Pilsen. Here's what we'll do. We'll take a break so we can get tonight's news. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation with Luis Rodriguez here at the Big Table. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Sam Panionovich. Talk about the Crosstown Classic. Talk a little bit about Derrick Rose, Bears Camp. That's all coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. And John Henson's going to join us, the former host of Talk Soup on E. He's got a new game show. We'll talk about hosting a game show. Ooh. Maybe that could be a new career path for you, Luis.
Yeah, that's what I need to do.
That's
yeah,
what you need
exactly.
to do. Luis Rodriguez is in studio tonight, the award-winning poet and author, the former poet laureate of the city of Los Angeles. His memoir, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., one of the best. And also, he is going to be at the Poetry Block Party put on by the Poetry Foundation, National Museum of Mexican Art, this weekend in Pilsen. Big affair. And he's in studio tonight. We've dedicated a lot of this conversation to talking about the ills of society. I mean, and more of your activism work than your writing, which I'm okay with, because I think that a lot of these topics come through in your work. Exactly. You've been writing about this. And, and like you said, I mean, you get in front of prisoners in North Carolina and you read some of your poetry and they understand.
Yeah.
How important is it as a writer to have that connection, to be able to write about the social injustices or about the things that affected your life for authenticity?
Well, I'll tell you what, how important it was when I was homeless in the streets of L.A. and I would go to the libraries. The books that spoke to me were those books, Malcolm X, Claude Brown, Man-Child in the Promised Land, Perry Thomas is Down These Mean Streets. These books of people that were living the life I was living. Now, they were all in Harlem and New York, and they were back east, but I related. They were all African-American. I'm Chicano, but I related to them. I said, you know what? I'm going through the same thing. When I read Malcolm X talking about how books saved his life, how he loved to read, I said, that's me. You see what I'm saying? Those books
having that relatable opportunity,
to let you know they weren't just talking about gang, they were talking about some hard stuff, but they weren't just talking about it. They were talking about transformative justice. They're talking about how am I going to change in the midst of this environment that won't let me change, don't want me to change. That takes a lot of power, and I wanted that. And I tried to give it to others. My book, people say, well, it's a rough book, it's hardcore, but they say, well, keep reading it, because when you read it, there's a transcendence going on. It ain't just one terrible crime after another.
That's a big part, because I mean, I remember the story. I mean, it was a popular book, and we're talking the 90s, and and they wanted to put it in libraries or schools, and there was pushback. You kind of got pushback, like, we don't want these tales of gang life to be. Yeah. But it is a transformative story. It's about, you know, the mistakes we make as youth, and sometimes it's pressed upon us by society. Sometimes it's our own mistakes and our own volition, but it's about how we learn from those mistakes and move and pass on to the next generation.
That's what good books can do. That's what good books do. That's what the writers said, like Nelson Algren, all the Chicago writers, you can name them all, James Farrell, Theodore Dreiser, all these writers that were writing about the poor white immigrant communities. You can translated with the black experience, translated to the Mexican, Puerto Rican experience. I was in Rockford. Rockford is one of the places where they banned the book. It was a big battle. I went down there in the 90s, talked to people. I just spoke there recently. 600 people showed up to hear me. I feel like, you know what, in the long run, I overcame. In the long run, people wanted to hear what we had to say.
Was that surprising to you? I mean,
it was mostly white people. In other words, it wasn't just people of color, mostly white people who are also suffering, who are also saying, where do I turn? You know what I'm saying? And I'm saying, well, we need to speak to everybody. I need to speak to them. People that Rockford's really getting hit hard. You know?
Let me ask you, I mean, one thing about, let me ask about your reaction, take you back to the sort of pushback to your memoir. The emotional toll, because here you are, somebody who wants to tell your story to younger people to help them make a better decision in their life. Yet you have society and forces in society saying your story is not good enough, or your story is one that we don't want to teach.
Well, it was going back to the time when my voice wasn't important, and they were saying it wasn't important, and they were trying to limit the voices. That's really what they were saying. They were trying to do that to Malcolm X, too. They were trying to do it to everybody else. But now it's my book, and it's like, you know what? My voice is important because it's the voice of a lot of people. It's not just me. It's the voice of a lot of people nobody wants to hear. And, of course, I think we lost a lot of it because mass incarceration came in, more prisons than ever before, but we also changed some of it. There is now more people understanding what a waste it was to put humanity behind bars and not do nothing. Rehabilitation, restorative justice, transformative justice, these are things that now everybody's talking about. You know, even Republicans are talking about it. Everybody's talking about this. So it's like, okay, we're going to this pendulum swing, but now we got to keep going. You got to save people's lives. You can't just throw them away.
Right.
You got to do more than just, even they do terrible things. Yeah, there should be consequences, but one of them should be their own healing capacity, that you give them tools and resources, let them change things. And, we need to just reimagine the whole thing because we're losing so many people. And it's just like a generating breeder that just keeps getting worse and worse. We're generating the violence that these kids are.
And I want to ask about the violence as well. I mean, it's interesting because your story is one that continually, I guess, is always being told. Because not only your story, but your family's story. Mm-hmm. And it's public knowledge about your son who went to prison. Yeah. He had a 28-year sentence, was an attempted homicide.
He did,
And he's out. He's out after 15 years. But talk about that. I mean, because it's not just your journey. It's a journey of your family. Even while you're going through trying to change people one by one, this happens in your family.
Yeah, and you know, my son did some terrible things. I don't justify, I don't condone it. He knows it. He did it, and I wasn't trying to save him from prison. I was trying to save him from being thrown away. They were going to give him 40 years to life. We fought that life sentence. They gave him 28 years. That's bad enough. But with the way things worked out, he fell in when there was an unconstitutional to do truth and sentencing here in the state, so he can do half time with good time. He, in that stretch, he did 13 and a half years. He did good time. He got his life together. He quit gangs and drugs in prison. He got sober in prison. It's hard to do.
That's hard to do.
And he did it in the main line, not PC, not protective custody. He did it where he was getting beat up, but he fought people. Guards, he says, were putting him in the hole, but he kept hanging in there. Eventually, they let him go. They respect him. Said, this guy's consistent. And now he's doing so good. He's crime-free, gang-free, and drug-free. Because we stood by him, and we fought for him, and we gave him tools. But he had to make those decisions, like I said.
I mean, was it hard for, was it hard for you as a dad?
It broke my heart.
It's your job. I mean, this is your job. Your job is to try and keep kids away from being in
the gang.
You
can't see it on radio, but the cover of It Calls Your Back is a homie holding a baby. That was me at 20 years old holding my son. And you know what? I made a promise to him. I'm not going back to heroin and gangs and jail. I'm not. And I kept that promise. It was him that changed me. And I'm thinking, I'm going to save my son. My son saved me. And then I got out. Now he's going through all this hell and back. What am I going to do? I can't step away from him. I got to go with him. His mother went all the way from East L.A., moved out to Chicago to be with him. We all were in jail, prison with him. But we stood by him. We gave him everything we could. Love, but not condoning, not saying that you did great. We didn't want to bring out the worst of him, but just to let him know he has family, he has community, and he has stepped up on his own. Again, the doors got open. He went through those doors. I'm very proud of my son.
Luis Rodriguez in studio. He is the poet and author of so many titles, award-winning author, poet laureate for Los Angeles at one point. All right, so let's talk about violence, and this is an issue that you continue to be involved with both in Los Angeles and here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. You talked about going, even today, talking to kids on the West Side where you want to be that adult that is there for them. And I have to ask the question, as I open up the paper yesterday and you see the story that homicides and shootings in Chicago are at a higher rate than last year. Last year was supposed to be an anomaly year. It doesn't look like that's the case. This looks like a new reality in Chicago. Are you optimistic that the tides can turn, or is this sort of the reality where we're at, that violence is permeating and will only increase?
Well, no, I think it could change, but we don't have the political will in the city and in the state of Illinois. And I know I've been watching it all these years. The police can't be the answer, neither can prisons. It's not to knock down police officers. They're actually being hurt by making them responsible for all the crime. There's a lot of family issues, a lot of economic issues, there's a lot of other issues, racial issues nobody wants to address. You got to deal with those things. You can't, and then just make the police the ones that are going to solve everything. Those guys are going crazy, and some of them are hurting our kids. So it's like, no, you just can't make it a police crime issue. You got to make it a community thing.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, you've been on the streets.
Came up with a plan.
All right, what is it?
It's called the Community-Based Gang Intervention Plan. We got the City of LA in 2008 to approve it. Now, they have a distorted version of it, but they're doing it. They got 12 communities in which they got a gang youth development program in 12 communities. Because we told them about peace zones that we were doing in Chicago. They basically created peace zones in L.A., and they're bringing resources in there. And, of course, the police are involved, but the resources, the whole idea is the resources are supposed to be more than the police. We've actually lowered crime in L.A. L.A. had more violence in the 90s with gang crime than Chicago did. The crime violence and gang violence in L.A. has gone down tremendously. Now, part of the problem is gentrification, people being pushed out, and there's a lot of other things nobody wants to talk about.
Meaning that the violence has gone down in Los Angeles because
they squeeze communities.
Those people have left, right?
The money is coming in. People can't live in some of these neighborhoods anymore. Boyle Heights, my old neighborhood, is all gone. Highland Park, I had a house there in the 80s before I moved out here. It's gone. This is also hurting us. They've got homeless encampments everywhere because nobody can go anywhere. Out there, you've got the beach. Where are you going to go? So now you've got 50,000 people homeless in the street of L.A. So, yeah, it's really bad. But I still think the answer is giving people the tools, the resources, and let them rebuild.
How does that? Okay, so you have a plan, and the plan that was somewhat adapted by the city of Los Angeles.
And I took it to Mexico.
Give us a little bit of. I mean, it's one thing to say, "Hey, we just gave resources."
It's multi-pronged.
How do you do it?
You give them economic resources. You retrain them. You give them arts, culture, imagination. You give them spiritual connections. I don't care which one it is, as long as they get spiritually going. You give them a sense that they can own their lives. You know, I remember during the LA uprising in '92, it was a big deal. But one of the things the Bloods and Crips came up with, and I wrote about it, I wrote articles and everything, was give us the hammer and the nails and we will rebuild our city. Nobody took them up on it. I would have done that. How bad could it be? Give them the hammer and let them rebuild. Okay, here's your challenge. Instead of killing people and drugs and everything, go ahead and rebuild the city. Right. Nobody took them up on it. We don't do that here. The gang thing's completely gone off the rails for a lot of reasons that people don't know. Those structures are not holding everything back anymore. The leaders have been all pushed away. There's no real leadership anymore. Okay, but what young people really want is to be part of something and purposeful, and to give them the capacity that they have, give them the way to build on the capacity.
You know, we had some people in studio, I just paraphrasing different voices that have been on the show here, and they talked about, it's an interesting conversation. We're talking about how kids, you know, there's a stereotype to these to kids on the West Side and the South Side that they're lazy, that they just want to be gangbangers, that they are interested in drugs and rap music and shooting people. Yeah. And then there's this anomaly story, this story that doesn't fit the narrative of the kid that gets up at 6 o'clock in the morning to sell loose squares on the corner, you know, where that's his trade. Now, it may be illicit trade, the same idea, but it's ambitious. It's 6 o'clock in the morning.
We set it up that way for them. And you know what? Last year, I spoke to some Southside kids, African-American Mexican kids. They were doing slam poetry at the Chicago State University. All these high school kids with their busloads. I'm there and no media was there. These kids were talking about change, redemption, peace. High school kids in Chicago talking about no more war, no more violence, and nobody was there. We don't want to hear that voice. It's against the narrative that we want to put out there, which is these kids are hopeless, they're killers, they don't got no more redeeming value, and therefore let's put them away. The narrative has to change. We have to help change it, because the real narrative is that these kids do want. I've seen it, and I had to say, where's the media here? Nobody's here for you all. I mean, you guys are doing good. Somebody gets shot there? They'll be there in a hot second. Mm-hmm. So I think the narrative has to change. These kids can be helped, but you got to give them that. You can't just look at it. It costs us billions of dollars to put this prison system. It's less costlier if we put it in the kids' neighborhoods. Honestly, it would have saved us more money. People think, well, that's saving money. They're not saving money. You're making it worse. And yet the kids come out even worse. They don't get any help. Very few. They come out in worse shape. They get out there in the streets. We trained them with tax dollars to be better criminals. It's like, it all makes sense to me. And I'm speaking to Republicans, Democrats. I'm not either one of them. You know, I was in the Green Party. I'm also now in the Justice Party. I'm in all independent parties I can join because I want to do something independent. But at the same time, I'm speaking to all of them and saying, listen, man, this stuff doesn't even make sense tax-wise. You know, we're losing more money by building these prisons and making police the number one way to handle this thing. We got to put it right in the communities.
Luis, as we wrap up, you know, it's been almost 20 years since I've seen you.
Wow.
Right? You look good.
Yeah.
But, you know,
thanks.
I guess I asked the question, you know, how long do you see yourself doing this kind of thing? Do you see yourself being an activist and going to talk to kids on the West Side of Chicago and continuing to be that adult? At a certain point, do you retire from that business?
I can't retire. I'm getting older. I'm 63 this year. I've been sober for 24 years.
Congratulations.
It's been a great journey, amazing, hard journey. But I still have something to say. And if I'm 80 years old, I think we've lost the idea of elders that are meaningful. And that's not really the fault of kids. A lot of elders just gave it up. We need elders who can speak to the world and society. We have people, again, running the government who are older, don't have anything powerful to say. They've lost their language. They have lost ideas. No, we still need to have them because that's what kids are looking for. Give me an idea. Give me something to hang on to, something that really makes sense. And nobody's out there anymore. We're just writing them off. I want to be, and not the only one, a lot of us want to be relevant in the lives of kids because of that genuine connection, not because I'm just an older guy and you should listen to me, but because I have something meaningful and powerful to help them.
As
understand.
You said, I mean, you were saying the same things when you were a kid to the elders.
I challenged them all.
That they're saying to you today
and most
in 2017,
of them walked away.
Right?
Yeah.
Luis Rodriguez, poet, author, award-winning author of so many titles, including Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. He is going to be at the Poetry Block Party put on by the Chicago Poetry Foundation and the National Museum of Mexican Art. That'll be this weekend in Pilsen. It's my pleasure to have you here. Great to see you.
Thank
Luis
you,
Rodriguez.
Justin.
I appreciate you being here.
All right. Thank you very much.
Great to see Luis again. I worked with him about 20 years ago on some essays. We had worked on essays. I was working on a magazine program, like a radio magazine, sort of like, what you would hear like an NPR kind of thing. And he was a writer. I had reached out to a bunch of writers in town, and there was a great group. Amy Cross Rosenthal was a part of that group, and John Green, who went on to be a tremendous YA author, and Daniel Ferry, who I think is in Australia, but he is just a tremendous talent. Mario Smith, who comes on the show a lot, and Luis. And, you know, it's amazing the work that he does. And, you know, like I said, I kept mentioning one or two of his works, but he has a ton. I mean, even holding up a book that he just carried with him. He had from 2010. It wasn't even new. He just had it. It was like ruffled, you know, edges of the book that he had that he was carrying around with him. I mean, there's just so much work. But, I mean, there's something to be said about the adults in our society who have reformed themselves and continue to be optimistic figures against a pessimistic world. And I can't speak for the listeners, and I'm sure there are a lot of you out there, but I can only speak for myself. But, you know, as much as I am concerned about my community and want to help young people find the light and find their way, I'm not sure that I'm out on a street corner trying to get that said individual to do that. You know, I mean, I could talk a big game, but I don't walk it. And guys like Luis Rodriguez do. I mean, he's been involved in so many different groups that have had their dedicated mission to try and help teenagers make better choices in impoverished neighborhoods. So he's got a cafe and bookstore in San Fernando Valley, which is the whole point. There's a serious gang problem in that neighborhood. And he opened up, and I forgot the name of it, but he opened up a cafe and bookstore based on his experiences here in Chicago, that slam poetry, like Wicker Park kind of vibe where there would be a stage in the back. And he brought that to a community that didn't necessarily ask for it. And today it's been there now for 15 years. I mean, it's 2002 or something. They opened it. And it's a place where I was reading this story today where 8-year-olds get up on stage and read about their experiences, and it's bilingual, and kids are making choices to create murals on the walls of that cafe and bookstore than to join gangs. So he does walk, he talks the talk, you know, there talks the talks and walks the walk. I mean, he does it. So if you're ever in the San Fernando Valley area, check out, I gotta get the name of it, but the Google Luis Rodriguez coffee shop.
The crime is down, but everybody's really jittery around caffeine.
A lot of caffeine.
No crime, but a lot of jittery people.
All right, coming up, Sam Panionovich. We'll talk Crosstown Classic and Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose going to the Cavaliers. And John Henson's going to join us, the former host of Talk Soup. He's got a new game show. We'll talk about what it means to be a game show host. It's a download. Stay with us. I feel like it would be blasphemy to talk over the great, what was that, a banjo? Was it banjo take me out to the ballgame?
I was playing that live. Thank you.
Oh, you were, yeah. Sorry. I have such respect for your craftsmanship on the banjo that I wouldn't want to talk over it, Pete. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Well, 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 what a Crosstown Classic we have. The first two games of a four-game set split at Wrigley Field. They now move to Guaranteed Rate, the G-spot, coming up tomorrow. A strange game at Wrigley today that featured pretty much every single baseball play. It was like there was even an infield fly rule where Anthony Rizzo dropped a ball on purpose. A lot going on at the park. We're going to talk with Sam Panionovich from WGN Radio Sports about that and about Derrick Rose moving to the Cleveland Cavaliers. Sam, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. I thought that was Super Mario Brothers. Take me out to the ball game, honestly.
What a game. I mean, was at first I was kind of like, okay, this is going to be, I mean, I would classify this game as a sloppy game, but as it went on, it got there a little intrigue. What to take away from a game that, that had five different players hit by pitch?
I thought the biggest takeaway was Carlos Rodon could be a really special pitcher if he ever is able to, you know, fine-tune his command. I mean, good Lord, he was all over the place today. I felt like he could have been out there with a blindfold and it would have been the same result because he walked a good amount of guys. He gave up four runs in four innings, including that three-run homer to Wilson Contreras. But, I mean, 11 strikeouts, including back-to-back strikeouts in that big inning. He was in a jam in the second, and he struck out Bryant and Rizzo back-to-back. I mean, he's got electric stuff, but the problem is he just can't put it together. That was fun. On the north side, Javi Baez struck out five times, one, two, three, four, five. And Joe Maddon said that he reminded them of John Daly with the driver, only the ball couldn't stay on the tee. But these games are always fun. I mean, you throw the record books out, and a lot of crazy stuff happens when the Cubs and Sox get together.
Let's talk about Carlos Rodon because, you know, this is eventually – I mean, this is his team when it comes to the pitching staff. The other pitchers in rotation right now are all journeymen. And Rodon, who really had the benefit of taking the first 2 months off of the season to rehabilitate his injury, he has not shown me that he is ace material.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, he threw under 35 innings in the minors in his whole career, so he was sort of rushed up here. And I think it's been the injury. It was sort of a question mark. Is it a shoulder? Is it an elbow? We never really got the full definition from the White Sox, and I think that was sort of fumbled by them out of the gate because, remember, early in April it was, he's on the 10-day DL, he'll be up shortly, and that wasn't the case. I mean, he made his first start a couple of weeks ago. So I think he was rushed back a little too soon. I don't know if he's ready. And I also think there's a lot of pressure on him because when they traded Chris Sale and the Sox shipped him to Boston, there was sort of this pressure. I don't know whether it's internally in Carlos's clock or it's from the White Sox organization. You have to pretty much replace Chris Sale. And that's no easy task. And I think given all around this roster and they're selling off and they're trading good pieces and just getting worse, he doesn't have a lot of help. So this year I think is sort of a wash. But I'm looking at the velocity. The velocity is fine. The strikeouts are up there. The control is the big thing. And if he's your ace, he's got to figure it out. Remember, Randy Johnson had problems early in his career with control. Nolan Ryan, the same thing. Roger Clemens, the same thing. Not that Rodon will be one of those guys someday, but, you know, when you're 24 years old, you have your whole life ahead of you. And I think he's still sort of learning on the fly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit disheartening that it's been, I think, three of the four starts that he's had this season, he hasn't gotten out of the fourth inning. And that's the part to me is that if you're going to be an ace, you have to eat innings, especially for a team that does not have a bullpen anymore. And you bring in guys whose sole job is to essentially plunk, you know, the Cubs coming out of the bullpen. That's essentially what you have right now.
Especially when you've traded everybody that's good out of your bullpen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's, you know, the bullpen comes in and Sox fans are shielding their eyes because they don't want to watch. I mean, even today, they traded Anthony Swarzak. They traded Robertson and Canely. They may trade Dan Jennings. I mean, pretty soon Justin Kaufman's going to be in that bullpen for the Southsiders. And that's not a good thing, but you're totally right. Your ace has got to go at least six, maybe seven. Most aces go eight. It's a long learning curve. Luckily, the White Sox are patient. They're patient with Rodon. They're patient with Tim Anderson, their shortstop, who's been struggling. And they're going to be patient with these young studs in AAA and AA and A-ball and all that because there's no rush to be good. This whole rebuild has bought them nothing but time.
So the Cubs, on the other hand, they let one slip away yesterday, but they seem to come back today. They're getting timely hitting from guys like Ben Zobrist and Wilson Contreras, who just seems to be on fire. John Lackey, I don't even know what to make of John Lackey, but I guess the big issue for the Cubs is many more rumors swirling around Justin Verlander and the idea of adding more to this team before the deadline.
They'll need another arm. In the postseason. Now, you know, most teams usually kind of trim it down to a four-man boat in the playoffs. You go 1, 2, 3, 4, so Lackey would ideally go to the bullpen, but you can never have enough arms. And I don't know if Verlander's big contract is headed here. I don't know if the Cubs have enough to get Sonny Gray. Yu Darvish is not happening. It may be a scrap heap guy, but they've got to do something because Sean Lackey just, he can't even go five innings anymore. I mean, he struggled to go five innings today against the third worst team in baseball. That's a problem. When you face the Dodgers, the Nationals, and some of those teams, and the Rockies, the Diamondbacks, he's going to get shelled, and that's certainly an issue. Now, you hope at the front end, you hope with Lesser 1, Quintana 2, Hendricks 3, you got something there. But, you know, a fifth starter is not going to make or break your World Series push,
right.
But certainly would help them win games because they're not runaway favorites to win this division. This is clogged at the top, and they need everybody. They need all 25 bodies going forward.
Yeah. The Cubs, of course, right now, right in the thick of it with the Brewers. This is the series today. I mean, I guess I have to ask the question as a responsible talk show host in Chicago, but what was the mood like after the game when in both locker rooms, the White Sox, of course, three of their hitters, big hitters, Abreu, Davidson, and Yoan Moncada, plunked by John Lackey today in one inning. I don't think I've ever seen that before where I thought it was Little League rules where he had to come out after that, but I guess not. And then, of course,
I had never seen somebody hit the bases loaded. That was the first. He literally, he didn't give up hits. He hit three guys in one inning.
In one inning.
Unbelievable.
Were the White Sox annoyed with that after the game? Was there talk about any animosity that might spill over to the rest of the series?
Well, time heals all things. And I think, you know, from the fifth inning on until the end of the game in the ninth, these guys had sort of letting it go. They let it go, especially when Chris Beck came in and plunked Ian Happ right in the quad, in the right quad. That sort of settled everything, and then both benches got warned. Matt Davidson, I talked to him, and he said Lackey just couldn't establish the corner. Same thing with Abreu through his translator, just said they were trying to pitch inside. So I don't think there's any vitriol there, no bad blood. Certainly you don't want to hit the bases loaded if you're John Lackey. And it was funny, the quote, I think, from Lackey that set it up best was they asked him if he was the opposing pitcher, how would he have reacted? And he said, oh, yeah, hell, I would have hit somebody too. So he understands it. It was just a lapse of control. No starter really had control this afternoon.
Yeah. Sam Panionovich out at Wrigley today, and the series, the Crosstown Classic, shifts to the G-spot starting tomorrow. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about the big story. Derrick Rose signs with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Ah, that hurts. that hurts my brain, Sam. All right, we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk more sports here on The Download. Stay with us.
Loud like church folk, heavy like workload, how you like Merkos, never saying Kirk F, bang like Kirko, ankle like Kirk, came back like Derrick Rose. She always get in her own way. When I try, she always
The news today here in Chicago is really about Cleveland. Derrick Rose signs with the Cleveland Cavaliers for veteran minimum, $2.1 million for a one-year contract. But he will play alongside LeBron James and probably not Kyrie Irving, who wants a trade out of Cleveland. What's it mean for the NBA and the hierarchy in the East? And more importantly, Sam Panionovich joins us tonight here on The Download, WGN Sports. This was a surprise to you that Derrick Rose would end up in Cleveland?
It made my stomach turn, honestly. I will echo your sentiment of, ugh, because, honestly, before I crossed over and joined the big bag media side of things, I was a super Derrick Rose fan. I played against him at Beasley Academy when he was there in grade school. I watched him shine at Simeon, and he was always like folklore on the South Side. Remember, he rose from the cracks of the South Side concrete, Englewood's finest, and he always wanted to play against the best and beat the best, and he never wanted to play with LeBron. He wanted to beat guys like LeBron. And here he is kind of walking hat in hand to all these different franchises now asking for big money. And he is rewarded, I guess, lightly with 1 year and $2.1 million by the Cavs. Now for him, it's a buy low, sell high type deal. You know, if he plays well, he may get a multi-year deal. But to watch J.J. Redick get 1 year and $23 million and Derek gets one and $2.1 million, to watch John Wall get four and $170 million. I mean, it's ridiculous to see Derek Rose fall from grace that fast.
Why? I guess there's a bias, of course. He's on and off the field. He's had injuries off the field. He's had scandals. So he's not necessarily a well-respected entity at this point. But to only get the veteran minimum like he's some sort of cast-off who can't play basketball anymore and they're just going to try him out seems very odd.
Well, there's a couple of different variables. I think number one is health. He hasn't played 70 games or more since 2011. He played 81 in his rookie year, then 78, then 81, and then he went 39. He missed a whole season, 10, 51, 66, 64. So durability is the first question. Can you be healthy? Can you help us win games long-term? That's number one. Number two, the fallout in New York when he just kind of disappeared and vanished and left the Knicks practice. They were supposed to play the next day, and he just didn't show up. That's a big deal, and people know about that. You can't just leave. This isn't Jewel Oscar or Walgreens. You can't just no call, no show. This is the NBA. And I think the third and most important thing is just X's and O's wise. You have to be a guy that can shoot the ball from three. If you're a point guard right now, look around the league. James Harden, Steph Curry, Damian Lillard, they can all stretch the floor and make that long range shot. Derrick Rose has never been able to do that. He's always going to put his head down and sort of batter into the paint and try and do some crazy layups, and that stuff doesn't fly anymore. So I think that's three things certainly working against him.
How does he compliment LeBron James or vice versa? I mean, the two of them really never played together. I don't even think they're on the Olympic team together. I mean, maybe in some of the national stuff, but I mean, even All-Star games, there was some drama around the fact that they all kind of danced out and Derrick Rose didn't, and it wasn't an affront to James. How are they going to get along both on and off the court?
Well, Derek's a pick-and-roll guard. He's a pick-and-pop guy. He's a guy who wants the high ball screen, and then he's either going to dart into the paint and try and make something happen and kick it out, or he's going to dump to the roll man. I think maybe they use a little bit of LeBron and Derek pick-and-roll. I mean, they have to be creative. But Derek probably, and all this talk about Kyrie Irving getting traded and wanting to be traded, look, Cleveland still has to trade him. I mean, they don't have to do it just because he wants them to do it. So I think Kyrie is maybe 50-50 that he'll be back. I think Derek is going to come off the bench. Last year he had 18 points a game. He's just offense off the bench, and he's going to be a guy that's probably going to run that second unit. If they do get rid of Kyrie, he's going to start. But it's tough to determine his role because he doesn't guard people well. He doesn't shoot well. So it's tough to say. And I honestly think in that Eastern Conference hierarchy, the Cavs have been eclipsed by the Celtics. Now, you still have to beat LeBron 4 times out of 7 in the postseason because LeBron's the best player in the world. There's no doubting that. But I think the supporting cast around Cleveland continues to deteriorate. And other teams like Boston, like Washington, they're only getting bigger and stronger.
I mean, if Kyrie Irving does get shipped out, what do the Cavs lose by replacing him with Derrick Rose?
Pretty much nothing. No, I mean, Kyrie is maybe a top 10 player in the league. He's a great shooter. He's an excellent ball handler. He's a guy that makes other people around him better. And he's a pretty decent, leader. I think he's a pretty good guy in that locker room. Now, make what you want of this current situation where he's reportedly asked for a trade. But, I mean, Irving is a really young cat. I mean, he's only 23, 24 years old. Derek's coming up on 30 right now. So with Kyrie, he's younger. He's more athletic. Mm-hmm. He's durable. He hasn't been hurt in years past. So it's just more of a sure thing right now. You know what you're getting with Kyrie Irving. He's a bona fide all-star. He's a superstar in this league. And with Derek, he's a question mark. You just don't know what you're going to get, and that's the problem.
Wow. I was reading some ESPN stuff a little bit earlier, I think it was Sunday or Monday, about Kyrie Irving really wanting to play with Jimmy Butler. That's why the Minnesota Timberwolves are on his list of desirable destinations. And there was question about whether or not Kyrie Irving, if he would have requested a trade earlier in the process, could have been a piece that could have worked to find a way for the Bulls to have Jimmy Butler and Kyrie Irving on the same team. I mean, are you hearing rumblings about Irving's, I guess, his loyalties and his desire to want to play with Jimmy?
We heard that, certainly. And, we talked about this multiple times on your show. When LeBron and D-Wade and Bosh first started to get cool with each other was in that Olympic run in 2008, when they were playing together on the red, white, and blue squad, and they built this bond that would last them a long time. And that's why they all went to Miami. They became friends with the Olympic team. Same thing goes for Kyrie and Jimmy Butler. Now, Kyrie wanted to play in Chicago. I want to go play at the house. I mean, we don't get everything we want, but the joke that I had was, I wonder if Gar Foreman knew about this, because he may not have even known. I mean, who knows about how Gar runs the things on the West side. It's interesting, I think, but the Bulls had committed to this plan. Now, even with Kyrie and Jimmy, are they better than Cleveland? I don't know. And Kyrie is certainly, Kyrie and Jimmy's a pretty decent 1-2 punch, but we don't know if there were any legs there. And I honestly look at that Bulls roster, and if you're the Cleveland GM, Justin Toffman's the GM of Cleveland,
what do you want
on that
right,
Bulls roster?
Exactly.
There's nothing. What do you want?
I don't even know. I mean, money.
So, I mean, it's not a video game. You can't just override the trade. You have to have two sides agree to a trade. And I just don't think Chicago has drafted and developed enough guys. Yes. Okay, maybe Bobby Portis. Denzel Valentine has been brutal. They haven't been able to allocate and develop young talent. And sure, Kyrie could have wanted to come to Chicago, but Cleveland's going to want something back in return. You can't just give him a bunch of basketballs and a couple orange cones. You want something back in return.
Sam, this is the last night in which we will talk NBA basketball, because tomorrow the Bears camp starts, so football takes over, and of course baseball continues to be a storyline here in Chicago. But I mean, we're not going to hear much about Chicago Bulls basketball till they start up in the fall after camp starts tomorrow for the Bears.
Roar. That's my Bears impression. You know, here's my thing with the Bears, and I don't cover the Bears. That's Adam Holzschapp. He does a great job. I just hope this is it. I hope this is the last hurrah for John Fox, because the guy just doesn't have it in him anymore, and the team doesn't believe in him, and he has this sort of punching match right now with Ryan Pace. I mean, Fox's days are numbered, and he makes him miserable to cover. It's tough to go in there. Nobody says anything. You can't even get an interview with the players anymore. It's tough to be around that team. It used to be fun to go to Alice Hall and to go down to Bourbonnais, and right now there's just so many restrictions and so many rules, and I just don't think it's a fun team. I don't think this team is having fun. So whether they win 5 games or 6 games or 7 games, it doesn't matter to me. This is the last year, hopefully, for John Fox, and then they bring in some young coach with some exuberance and some energy, and they can guide this team to the next level. It's just, you have an old man with a corncob pipe and a top hat and, you know, just like socks and sandals, and he's so out of touch with this team, and it couldn't be more clear to me. I don't know if anybody else can realize this, but, yeah. I mean, the team, they're just not good, and they're rebuilding sort of like the White Sox are, sort of like the Bulls now are. It's just, you got to get somebody else in charge to rile these guys up, because old man River is not cutting it anymore.
Well, you know, I feel that too. You know, with my predictions right now, I mean, before camp starts, I say, you know, and this is a very, I'm being very liberal, but 12-4 is where I see.
Oh, yeah, you must have been drinking again. Here's the over-under in Vegas. It's 5.5. So, okay, maybe it's 5, maybe it's 6. Either way, woohoo, 5 or 6 wins. Congrats, you'll be in last place again. They need to do a better job of bringing in talent. They have to draft better. They have to develop better.
My last question, because and this is a pet peeve of mine. Are you upset as a Chicagoan that Fox announced that Jay Cutler is going to be in the booth for game one against the Falcons? Does that tick you off?
No, I think he's going to be great in the booth, honestly. And here's why. He's in the NFC, the NFC package that's brought to you by Fox. He's been sacked by every team 100 times. I mean, he knows every defense. He's going to be great in that booth.
Or doesn't know the defense, right?
When you look at Jay Cutler, the player. Honestly, the player Jay Cutler, he always wanted to invade his huddle and talk about his throws. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? We don't do that anymore. And now he's going to go into other huddles and other decisions and other quarterbacks' minds. And I think you'll really be surprised at how colorful he is and how quick-witted he is. I'm looking forward to it.
Ugh, wrong answer. I'm getting close to boycotting the Bears because of that decision. I just feel like we finally got rid of Jay Cutler. We can move on. That's a big part of healing as a Bears fan. And the idea that Fox is trolling us by putting him in the booth on week one, I find it not only unacceptable, but a game changer for me. I'm going to go horseback riding and not watch the Bears.
Give him a chance. Give him a chance.
I gave him a chance. I gave him 8 years.
As an analyst. Right. Give him a chance as an analyst. He'll be fine.
Sam Panionovich, thanks for joining us, bud.
Peace out.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk with John Henson, the former Talk Soup host. Now he's got a new game show called Eyewitness. That's coming up right after the news, sponsored by Timeshare. ExitTeam.com, 9:33. Hey, Rob.
Yes.
Are you as mad as I am about Jay Cutler being in the booth for the first game, the regular season game where he takes on the Bears take on the Falcons at Soldier Field?
Right. So let's just think of this logically. The Bears and the Falcons. This is not a huge ratings bonanza. So let's put the cherry on top of this Sunday, and that is Cutler. People are going to tune in just for the curiosity to see how he's going to do.
I get. I just feel like it's a troll move.
Yeah.
Like we cut him. We finally get a game that doesn't have any Cutler on it. You don't know it. He's not hurt. He's not a storyline. He's not throwing interceptions. And yet Fox is like, I got an idea. Let's insert him back in. And I don't know. As a Bears fan, I want to move on. And I feel like if Fox is not going to let me move on, then I'm moving on myself.
It's going to be interesting to see the post-broadcast analysis of his performance. Are we going to be like, he's got a... got a big booming voice, but he just couldn't hit that highlight down the field. just couldn't quite connect with that highlight. He overthrew the highlight.
He's going to have to do a press conference about his performance. That's great.
Did you feel bad you fumbled up on that one exchange?
I just was good with the offense gave me, you know.
Kenny Albert.
Come on.
Hey, yes!
All right.
Jay!
Hey. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new game show Eyewitness is currently in the middle of a summer run on Channel 50. The show presents contestants with video clips, and the questions come from what they just saw. It's being produced by a couple of people, Fremantle Media and Judge Judy, and it stars host John Henson. Henson's no stranger to TV. He's well known for his run as the host of Talk Soup on E! And, of course, hosting the ABC game show Wipeout. John's also an actor, starring in projects for both film and television. But for Eyewitness, he's the quintessential game show host. Eyewitness is currently airing on Channel 50, the CW, weeknights at 5 p.m. And it is my pleasure to welcome John Henson to the Download tonight. John, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Justin.
It's fun to get back in the saddle, do another game show. This one, obviously, different than Wipeout. But what's it mean to be a game show host?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I've had the good fortune to be in TV for a long time. And as I have gotten older, I think the idea of the right game show has kind of become the brass ring in my eyes. It is kind of the perfect intersection of hosting and stand-up and improv, and kind of draws on all of the things that I've done over the course of my career. So it's been something I've had my eye on for a while.
Are you the kind of guy who looks or has studied the greats that have hosted game shows in the past, or do you sort of make it your own?
Look, I mean, I was a TV kid growing up. I watched all of the iconic game shows when I was a kid. You know, things like Match Game and the Newlywed Game and, you know, $20,000 Pyramid. Whatever the game show of the moment was when I was a child, I was watching. I was one of those latchkey kids. But I think, you know, the modern game show has evolved a little bit, and I think there's probably a lot more opportunity to bring your personality to a game show than maybe there was when I was a child. This is a game show in Eyewitness that is largely unscripted. Other than the rules and the questions, it's about improvising in the moment and enjoying your time with a contestant. So it's very freewheeling. It's a lot of fun.
As an improviser and having that freedom to not have a heavy script around you in Eyewitness, you know, you still have to make the show about the contestants, make the show about what's happening with the video clips and whatnot. Do you have to think about the balance when you're riffing with a contestant and going off script?
Well, you know, you have to keep in mind the day period and the people that are watching. This is not sort of a late night vibe or even a more irreverent and edgy vibe in a show like Wipeout. You're going to be playing to an audience that's looking for something a bit more mainstream. So I check myself, certainly. I'm conscious of my audience, but I think my position, I just want to stay in the moment. I want to make sure that I am listening and that I'm not trying to jam comedy in. I'm just trying to make use of the natural opportunities that arise from the gameplay.
You've done a lot of work in your time. I mean, of course, everyone knows you as the host of Talk Soup on E! And your long run with Wipeout. But when you watch Eyewitness, this is the set looks like a game show. The audience is trained like a game show. I mean, this really is almost a throwback to that 80s game show. Talk about that experience to perform in when you're in a soundstage in L.A. and you're doing that kind of show. How different is that for you, and how particular is that experience?
It was a realization. When I walked out onto the set my first day in the studio and I saw how big and splashy the set was, it really, to me, looks like a primetime network game show. And I was really blown away by the size and scope of the production. I mean, it looks like a big money production. You know, I'm a guy that has spent a lot of my career in front of a green screen, you know, in smaller, more humble studios that look like a prop closet compared to the set of Eyewitness. So, you know, it was like, wow, this is for real. This is a big deal. And I think you're right. I mean, I think this really does sort of feel like what you think of when you think of a game show, a live audience, contestants, a lot of in-the-moment comedy, and a lot of unscripted great moments. But, you know, it's a lot of fun to host this show. I mean, this show, to me, is such a strong concept that I just get to go along for the ride. I mean, it really is a show that I think is entertaining, not just for the contestants, but for the audience at home to watch, both from the perspective of, you know, enjoying watching other people play and, you know, kind of comparing your own skills and playing along at home.
I feel like I just pulled out of an old board game that I had with my son, and it was a Marvel Comics or a DC Comics flip the tile kind of game, you know, where you had to recall. And that's what I thought automatically. I got shivers watching Eyewitness because I'm like, I know that. I'm not good at this. This is not my style.
You know, I got to tell you, I am a far better suited to be a host than a contestant on this. I mean, it really does give you an appreciation of how challenging it is to take in all these details, even when you are focused and trying to pay attention, and moments later you're getting the questions, and you kind of go, wow, man, I would be lost if I were on the other side of these questions. It's a lot of fun. I just ran into, believe it or not, I took my family to Catalina this weekend, and on the streets of Catalina, I ran into a guy who was one of the very first grand prize winners on Eyewitness. He was literally in Catalina with his wife spending his winning. And I remember saying to him, man, I'd be a heck of a lot better at this game than I would have been. You know, it is a lot of fun, though, and it does sort of, you know, I think it falls into that. It smacks of classic game shows and the kind of thing that, you know, I think in the right circumstances could be around for a long time.
John Henson is the host of the new show, game show Eyewitness, which is running on Channel 50, 5 o'clock weeknights. It's interesting because I think of television right now, and a lot of television writers and actors will talk about the myriad opportunity, the golden age of television when it comes to Amazon and Netflix and, you know, other streaming sites giving more and more opportunities to writers and performers. Is it similar for your work and for game shows? When I think about the game show network, I know that, and I think of, you know, networks that will put programs on traditionally at 5, 6 o'clock, you know, the Wheel of Fortune, things like that. Is this sort of a golden opportunity for or golden days for game shows as well?
That's an interesting question. I think, you know, certainly reality TV was a bit of a gold rush in terms of hosting opportunities. This is a bit, as you said, a more classic game show than the kind of competition-style reality shows that even Wipeout would have fallen into the category of. You know, I think the thing that is different now is that in the world of hosting, it is wide open. In other words, you have Michael Strahan, a former professional football player who's a host. You have Jamie Foxx hosting, an Academy Award level actor. You have former boy band members, you know, that are hosting. It's a world where, you know, kind of anyone that is well known to an audience is a potential host. So while there might be more opportunities, I think the playing field and the competition level is wide open. There's a lot of people vying for those jobs.
As a comedian and improviser, and that's your stock in trade, and you had the great fortune of hosting Talk Soup and then moving into more hosting with Wipeout. You still do acting gigs. I see you on television here and there. You're in some films as well. Can you have a career where you're a game show host on a network and then at the same time showing up in gritty independent films on the side?
You know, I think that's probably more of a possibility today than in years past. You know, I came out of the world of stand-up and to a lesser degree improv, and my first opportunity was in the hosting world. Once people see you do something successfully, that tends to be the way they see you. So if my first opportunity had been in a sitcom, it could be that it would be an uphill battle for me to get a hosting job, and people would see me primarily as a sitcom actor. It's the reverse for me, and I think people tend to see me as a host. You know my wife, Jill Benjamin, who's also a comedian. At the end of my run on Wipeout, Jill and I went out to dinner, and I said, you know, maybe I'll write a movie. Maybe I'll write a sitcom. I've never done that before. My wife got very quiet and just sort of nodded politely. And I said, what? She goes, why don't you just host television shows? That's what everybody wants you to do. You're good at it. They pay you well. Just do the one thing everyone wants you to do. Why do you have to pick the one thing everyone wants you to do and try to do that. And I laughed and I said, you know what, honey, you're a good woman. I'm a lucky man. Thank you very much. And, you know, the reality is if people want to give you work, you take what they give you. I do think that, you know, when you have film stars coming to work in reality television or game shows, it is a more open playing field than past.
John Henson is the host of Eyewitness, the game show that's currently in the middle of a summer run on Channel 50. It airs the CW. It airs weeknights at 5 o'clock here in Chicago. John, a longtime host, host Talk Soup, of course, on E! And Wipeout. John, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Hey, man, thank you so much. It was great to catch up with you. I hope all is well with you.
All right, thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for The Worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. 312-981-7200. We got a lot of texts and calls coming in already because the prizes tonight are hot. A pair of weekend tickets, weekend admission, they say, to the 20th annual Wizard World Comic-Con. August 24th through the 27th. Also got a pizza. Also got some tickets to the Metropolis Performing Arts Center. So we got a lot of stuff. We also have Mars Timms in studio tonight. How you doing, buddy? Good to see you.
Oh, man. It's always a pleasure to be here, Josh. You know, just chilling late right. night on a weeknight. You know how we do.
A regular here on the download, The Worst. You can go see his show, Pimprov, which is every Friday night, 10:30 at CIC Theater. 1422 West Irving Park Road. That's Friday nights, 10:30. But like I said, Mars is with us all the time, and he is back. 312-981-7200. All right, let's kick it off. Let's start tonight like we start every night with Pete Zimmerman. Pete, what's the worst?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst?
The inconsistencies in air travel. When you go someplace and you're in the security line, are we taking off our belts and shoes in this line? Are we not taking our shoes off? Are we taking our stuff out of our bag? Are we leaving our stuff in the bag?
You're really
telling me. Just give me one thing to do, and I'll get in line quietly.
Very 80s stand up tonight. Really. I've just gotten recently into, I binge watched Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah.
And there's a great moment where all she knows is 80s stand-up because that's what she watched. So like there's half the episode she's just doing, what's the deal with airline peanuts? And everyone's laughing. It's so good.
I know. I saw that. It was so good.
Yes. Airline. I mean, what I can't stand is I feel like even beyond that, the idea of what lane is open, how it's open, who's using what. You're right. I mean, it is the wild, wild west on purpose.
Yeah.
With airlines.
No airport is the same. I've been to so many different airports, and it's just like, all right, here you don't have to do any of that stuff. You just breeze right on through. But then it's just like, oh, wait, you forgot to take this toothpaste out of your bag, so we're going to have to take that all the way back. It's like, really, the toothpaste? Yeah.
It's pretty ridiculous. You're right. Absolutely. There, you'll go through some, and I think of the airport in Fort Myers, Florida. Mm-hmm. When you go through there, you're like, this is a dream. You're like, wow, everyone's coming back from vacation. You're like, oh, this is so great. Oh, I don't take anything else. I get a glass of wine going through security. This is so great.
Right.
And you roll through O'Hare, you're like, I'm sorry. Yeah. You say I'm sorry before you even get in line. I'm so sorry, I didn't mean it.
As soon as those doors open, you're just like, oh, why do I really need to go on this trip? Maybe I should have drove. Yeah,
maybe I should have drove.
12 hours.
And then you got to wait in line for the rental car.
Right.
312-981-7200. All right, what do you got tonight, Mars?
I have when a coffee shop calls out the wrong name. You give them your name, and they are just adamant that that is your name, and it's not. Marv, small coffee, extra cream and sugar.
Yeah, that's
Marv.
Me. It's Mars. It's me. You're Marv?
you're Marv. No, Mars. Really? Because it says Marv here. I didn't write it.
As somebody who's worked in a coffee shop and under very busy mornings and have been in charge of writing names, I don't hear people. I think it sounds like Marv. I'm going to put that down.
Yeah.
I don't.
But who?
I don't understand.
I come from as an alum of a coffee slinging alum. Mm. I've worked in coffee shops, but I came from a generation that didn't write things on cups.
Yeah.
You said double calf, decaf, grande mocha latte. And they go, "That's me." And you're like, "There you go." You know, like I never in any situation was ever like, "Is it Randall? You got one for Randall?" No, I'm, right?
I mean, hey, I'm Shoshana, and I've been waiting. I haven't heard my name.
Right.
Did you order a black coffee? Yeah, then you could have just said that.
You could have just said that. Yeah. Grande coffee. Right. I feel like these new baristas, they have it so easy. It's by name. Yeah. All right, 312-981-7200. You know what's the worst for me, Mars? I've been pushing it all night. Jay Cutler being the announcer for week one Bears-Falcons. Color commentary. He's in the booth, Mars.
Why?
Because Fox
so
is trolling us.
Yeah, they
because
clearly,
Fox is like, "I got a great idea." That's I just summed up an ideas meeting in the back of a Fox lot in California. Like, "I got an awesome idea that's really going to piss off Chicago. Are you ready for this?" Jay Cutler in the booth, first time ever. Color commentary. I don't want that. Yeah. It's enough for me to not watch the Bears. I'm like, no, I don't want to watch Jay Cutler.
I'll watch it if the entire time he's talking about players and their facial expressions and their demeanor on the field. He's like,
he's just got the wrong body language.
Kevin White has the wrong body language after dropping that pass. That's no good. It's no good.
I don't know. I mean, Sam Panionovich was on earlier saying we'll be surprised by it. You know, he'll be a great analyst, but I don't care if he's the greatest analyst since sliced bread. I don't want Jay Cutler in my football anymore.
No, not in Chicago.
Right.
You can put him anywhere else. Don't put him back in Chicago. We just got rid of him.
We'd like a Cutler-free year.
We'd like a Cutler-free year.
That's all I'm saying. Right?
They're going to cut to him in the booth, and then somebody's going to call him and be like, look at his position in the booth.
Yeah, what's going to happen is it's going to be the first storyline will be the Bears got dismantled, and that'll be a quick one. That'll be a 1 minute, and they'll be like, "When we come back, how did Jay Cutler do in the booth?" And it'll be like, "No, don't." Yeah. He's going to be in the highlight package. Yeah. He's going to be in the local news. They're going to debate him. "I think he did good. I think he did bad." Like, it's like, no.
Yeah, we don't need that.
We're trying to get over. It's like a breakup. We're trying to get over, man. We don't want Cutler hanging out at the party.
Exactly. And asking about, they're going to ask him, "Oh, what does Jay think about those new quarterbacks the Bears have?" It's like,
they're going to have to give Mitch some time. Shut up.
Right.
Nobody asked you. Literally, nobody wants you here.
The first time a quarterback misses a receiver, really, we want to hear Jay Cutler say, "Oh, he definitely should have hit that guy." Yeah. Really, Jay?
When you Mike really Glennon throws in a double coverage and it's picked off, and Cutler goes, "You know, he read that wrong." That 708 says, "I'll watch if he promises to apologize the entire broadcast." See, there you go. I'll take that. If he's up there going, "I just want to start the broadcast by saying I know nobody wants me here."
Right.
And it's really important that I say this. I was terrible. Yeah. And I set this franchise back. And I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
So let's see. 3rd and 8. And then they move on with the game.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
All right.
Even better if they put him in the booth with like Mark Trestman and Lovey Smith.
Let's go to Mark Trestman on the sidelines.
John Shoup.
Yeah, John Shoup.
Let's go down to John Shoup. "Well, here's what they're doing wrong on offense." No, it's like waking up in cold sweat if you're a Bears fan. Mars Timms, and I'm Justin Kaufman. It's the worst. 312-981-7200. John's on the line. I got a slew of texts here. Everybody wants those Comic-Con tickets. 312-981-7200. We're complaining about the worst things in society. For prizes, stay with us.
Going down,
it's the worst. 312-981-7200. Mars Timms in studio. Check him out with the show Pimprov. Friday nights at 10:30 at the CIC Theater, 1422 West Irving Park Road. All right. We've got a lot of great texts and callers on the line, so let's get to it. We're playing for some awesome prizes, including passes to the Wizard World Comic-Con Chicago at the Donald Stevens Convention Center coming up at the end of August. Let's start it off with John. John, what's the worst, John?
Hey, guys.
Hey.
The worst, the absolute worst, is people with umbrellas who hug the building and poke out the eyes of people like me who don't have an umbrella. We're using the building to kind of be, depending on which way the wind's blowing, you can maneuver.
Right.
And you got to be somewhere, and you got these people with umbrellas that are poking you in the eyes, hugging the building. Go out in the middle of the sidewalk.
Yeah, they have the protection, umbrella. Right? You're using the scaffolding, you're using the building edges, you're makeshifting, right? I get it.
and you got people with umbrellas and they're boxing you out. It's unbelievable. It's horrible. It's the worst. And it's really been the worst the last month when we have all this rain.
Right, right.
Yeah.
All right.
They
good,
are
good stuff.
Punishing
good start.
You for not checking the weather before you left home.
Yeah, it's double punishment. All right. Thanks, John.
Well, you know, I'm not a good umbrella guy, you know, and on the rare occasion when I borrow an umbrella from a coworker, I always stay in the middle of the sidewalk away from the edge of the wall.
There you go. Thanks, John.
Umbrella etiquette.
Thank you. Umbrella etiquette with John. Okay. All right. 815. I'm going to go the text right here. This one I like right off the bat. I'm writing it down because I think this is going to be one that I think will be a finalist.
Okay.
815 says, when you sand a difficult piece of furniture so long and so hard that your iPhone no longer recognizes your thumb scan.
Whoa.
So like you're ripping off your thumbprint?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mr. Fix It.
I don't know if that's relatable, but it seems like it'd be the worst. Seems like it'd hurt.
That's obsessive. It's a little overdoing it.
I like that one. 224 says the worst is one kid had a small medical thing today. Other two had to sit in the hall, didn't have a sitter. Told them to stay in their chairs. 3-year-old took it literally. When we left, the chair was all wet. Emergency trip to Target because we forgot the just in case bag. Mommy fail. So they peed in the. That's all right.
Yeah,
that is the worst though.
Yeah,
that's lit. When I would say, any 3-year-old taking anything literal is the worst.
Mm-hmm. I've been there as well. I didn't do that, and if I did, I probably didn't know. But having a son, probably. Yeah. He's
this
done
is when
that.
When the lesson you reach down and you say, "Do you not understand context?"
Right. Right. I didn't mean to stay there if you need to go to the bathroom. Just, all right.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. You're 3.
815 says the worst is that 16-year-old girl who was driving drunk and streaming herself and then killed her sister when she crashed a car, but she continued to stream it. What? That's a news story. You can't say the worst is the news.
Right. That
is terrible. That's a terrible story. That's why it's in the news. It is the worst.
That is the worst.
I think the newscaster said, now turning to the worst. Yeah. That's a terrible story, but
yeah,
that's just you're right. You know what's the worst? I guess Jay Cutler is the same concept.
That texter took it too literally.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Here's a good one. 773 says, the worst is when you order the second Savage Garden CD from Amazon. Okay, the second. It comes sealed, and when you open it, you realize that while the case says it's 2, they actually put the first CD back in the second CD's cover. What? Wow. Savage Garden.
the worst is buying the first Savage Garden CD.
Well, this guy's got 2 of them now. This woman's got 2 of them.
Congrats.
So. Savage Garden. Ordering Savage Garden CDs on Amazon.
Yeah.
You just get that, like, just pick your best tracks and maybe pick $1.29 off of Apple. That's
exactly.
Second Savage Garden record is great all the way through. That's just my guess. It's probably some good parts, but I don't know if it's
classic material. Right? You have to listen to it from beginning to end. Savage Garden.
815 says, I just turned 35, and for the first time since I was 20, my mother told everyone that attended my birthday dinner the story of my birth. I'm talking the whole 9 yards, the tearing, the yelling, the walking funny, and the peeing all over herself. I know I was a tough birth, weighing 10 pounds, 4 ounces, but I work with these people.
That's my front runner right there. That is my front runner. That is all right, worst.
I'm writing it down. Birth story at 34. Okay. All right. Here's another one for you. This is right near the top 3. So far, 708 says the worst are guys who hang rubber scrotums off their truck bumpers. That's the worst. That is the worst.
Yep.
Where did you see that? And where'd you go? I gotta do this.
There's a pair of look at a pair of balls on that truck.
Where are you going, honey? I'm going to the scrotum store. I think it's a really great choices. I'm gonna put on the back of my pickup.
I actually just drove back from Omaha and stopped on a 80 at the world's largest truck stop.
There are a lot of that. Hey, that's where you get them. I was going to ask. Mars knows where you get them.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so let me write this down. Scrotum truck. All right, I'm just keeping it. I'm being more organized tonight. 708 says, the worst are tourists on every corner who step onto the bus to ask directions to Millennium Park. He's not your personal tour guide, and I need to get to work.
Ooh.
I guess when you get, so tourists get on a bus and they say, how do I get to Millennium Park? And they slow the process down. That is bad.
That's tough. You need one of those old grizzled Chicago bus drivers, though. They're just driving while they're talking.
I always do it my way. Whenever I have a question to get on a bus, I turn up the Chicago dial to about 9. So I go, hey, buddy, where's Wacker? Like, I turn into my dad a little bit in the way that, like, it's sort of like, hey, Millennium Park, this way? And he goes, yeah, it's going to be right down here, like 2 blocks over by there. All right, good. So then I feel like I'm...
Go get myself some Garrett's popcorn.
Yeah.
Aren't we in an era of not asking for directions anymore, though?
Got GPS, right?
I mean, when was the last... I can't even remember the last time I've asked for directions. Even, you know, traveling in other cities. You know, I have my phone. You got my things out.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it when I am in a spot
call
where someone asks me, hey, which way is Racine? And I have the answer, and I'm right there, and I'm like, it's going to be the one... It's the light. Right there, that light. Keep walking, and that light. Like, I go too far in my to make it sure that they know that I know.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good.
Yeah, on multiple occasions, I've given someone the wrong directions and then walked away and been like, they'll figure it out.
It's also bad when somebody asks you, conversely, Justin, when, you know, I've been in a situation where, you know, you have some civic pride. You want to, like, be able to tell somebody, and they're like, where is the hotel, blah, 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 and you're like, you have no idea where that is. Like, oh,
do you don't know the address?
You feel like you're such a failure.
That must be new. No, it's the historic.
Buckingham Fountain. I went on a field trip there when I was a kid. I should know this. Chicago.
Do you have a phone?
Yeah.
Can I look something up real quick?
Siri, where's Buckingham Fountain? I don't even ask Siri for directions. I just punch it in myself.
No, it's just right into the Google Maps. All right, 630 says the worst is the horrible diesel particulate laden air you breathe while waiting and boarding the train in Union Station. It's probably worse than chain smoking a pack of cigarettes. I know that smell. That chemical smell that comes off a train where you're like, someone designed this poorly.
Yeah.
I'm a human being, and I'm guessing these aren't human being friendly fumes.
No.
Right?
Yeah. That. And
the worst is when the doors are shut, like at a metro station or a Union Station where they haven't opened them yet, and you're like, so now I'm just stuck here.
You're right. You're standing on that platform, and the train's just right there in your face, just idling, just like...
Like an idling commuter train. Yeah. is there anything worse than an idling commuter train? There you go. 219 says the worst thing in society, all caps, people who have extended and loud personal conversations on their mobile phones, not just at Juul, but in usually quiet places like doctor waiting rooms, bookstores, state parks. It's a weird extra there.
State parks.
You got the waiting rooms, the bookstores, the state park.
The rainforest.
One of these things is not like the other,
right?
I like it, and that won a couple weeks ago. The idea of the loud, it's the, you know what, we added to that the FaceTime conversation.
Oh,
that has become the new. I was just in the Dunkin' Donuts, and the woman in front was barely talking to the guy while she was FaceTiming somebody. I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, that's just over the top. We have to. That's just, now we're out of control.
Yeah, the people that just walk down the street with the phone held up right in front of their face having a conversation. It's like, you're going to walk into somebody. You're going to get hit by a car, hit by an Uber driver because they don't know where they're going. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Green line, public talking. Oh my God. Yeah, you want to talk about public conversations. Green line. Ride the green line.
You just mean public people trying to talk to you or just conversations happening around you?
Conversations happening around me. The green line.
Train conversations, loud train conversations, not with phones notwithstanding. Just personal public conversations are the worst.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The only thing that beats that would be a plane conversation. If you're on a plane and someone is like, I don't know you. Hi, I'm Jake from Omaha. Hey, I'm Justin from Chicago. So what do you do? And it's that loud while you're just waiting on the you're taxiing and everyone's quiet. And he's like, I'm in pharmaceuticals. I do a lot of manufacturing on the side. You're like, shh.
I travel a
lot.
What's
the matter with
you?
Yeah, like keep it down. You can have that conversation. Yeah. But just don't be so loud. Know that like I'm six rows up and I can hear you.
Yeah.
Good stuff tonight.
I'm an earphone guy. As soon as I get on the plane, earphones in. Yep. Earphones in. Don't talk
to me. I do the fake sleep.
Okay.
Right away, seatbelt on. Yeah. So like if somebody sits down, they're not bothering me. Hey, don't and people are in Michigan Avenue looking. Don't if you see me, don't call my bluff.
Yeah.
We're playing.
Hey, I saw you. You're WGN.
You're not sleeping.
You're not sleeping. Wake up.
It's a download. We're playing the worst. 312-981-7200. We got a ton more texts and people on the lines. Mars Tim's in studio tonight.
It's going down. Worst come the worst, my people come first. When worst come the worst, my people come first.
All right. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mars Tim's in studio. We are playing the worst, 312-981-7200. We are complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. And we have prizes tonight. A pair of tickets to the 20th annual Wizard World Comic-Con Chicago coming up at the end of August 24th through the 27th. Someone on Twitter said, oh, man. They always sell those out by the time I get to ordering. So this is a big, people are excited for this. So you can tell by the way that people are reaching out with great worst tonight. We have some, we already have some finalists, some thoughts here. So let's go through what we have. We have a ton of stuff here.
Yeah.
It's so fun. 312 says the worst is when the know-it-all old guy at work hands out 22 Xerox pages from a book instead of sending a PDF prior to the meeting. Office humor. I love it. It is true. Like anytime you're like, you know, there's technology for that.
Right.
The 22 pages each to every person around the table.
We don't need that. We can read it off the computer screen. But it's better if it's in your hands. You can feel it and absorb the knowledge.
I've been here since 3 in the morning.
You realize I have to collate all this.
I got toner all over my hands. 817 says the worst people who continue to jog in place at a red light or a stopped intersection.
I like that one. I like that too.
Gotta keep my momentum.
Gotta keep
check
moving.
My pulse. Keep moving. Keep moving. Don't stop. Keep moving.
Yeah, and then you get in like the you go battle with them. It's like, no, just go. And they're like, no, you go. You go. I'm good jogging right here in one spot. You can go ahead. And it's like, would you just run across the street? Nope, I'm good jogging right here. Go ahead.
Do joggers who jog on the street, you know, when they don't go in the crosswalks, do they become more like, do they lose their pedestrian distinction? Do they become more like bikers? Where they have to stop at stoplights and things like, you know what I mean? Because like you could always argue that a pedestrian is going to have the right of way if they're jogging, but if they're not in the traditional
sidewalk.
Where they're supposed to be, if they're jogging next to cars where like bikes are usually at, do they
That's
take on
question.
More of like? Bikes?
I don't know.
Yeah,
don't know.
You know what? I'll get a guess. We'll do an hour and a half on it.
Okay.
We'll do a
we
big
have
table.
Professional jogger here.
Professional joggers will be in studio next week for the professional jogging series here in the download.
You know what's the worst? When people cut me off when I'm jogging in the middle of the street.
708. The worst is when your boss asks you to stop by his or her office, and when you do, there's an HR rep sitting in there.
Yeah,
Dave, we're just checking your emails here at the water department, and just forwarding a lot of weird stuff.
Yeah. I get you. Everybody has their own sense of humor, but this could stop.
You could just stop forwarding every email. All right, we keep going. All right. Jerry's back, 630. He says, the worst is that Sears stopped sending the full catalog to my home. I really miss my favorite section. I'm relegated to reviewing older models and out-of-fashion bras from years ago. Jerry's got a bra thing. He brings it up every week. Yeah,
I see. Sears?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. that just reeks of old anyway, right?
It really does. 630 says, the worst was taking a car I haven't taken out of the garage for a very long time. You get all nice and cleaned up, you detail it, and then going to the gas station, you back it up into an extremely long, very low to the ground flatbed trailer blocking the entire gas station that I couldn't see whatsoever backing up, and I smashed the entire back bumper of my car. Yeah,
that's pretty
bad. So it's like you took out like the 68 Corvette.
Yeah.
I'm just going to take it to the gas station back.
I'm going to take it out today. Today's the day.
Today's the day.
Sun's shining. Every conditions are right. No salt on the ground. And what's that?
That's that sound.
Yeah. It's like Ferris Bueller's day off moment.
Today, here's the worst. A huge hawk swooping down and savagely destroying my favorite little bunny while he was waiting for me to feed him carrots. I feel terrible. I feel like I fattened him up for the kill.
You sure
now
did.
I feel guilty for feeding them and mad that the bunnies were eating all my flowers. The hawk saw me and left the bunny destroyed but not eaten. Oh, that's a lot going on there. I feel bad for you, 630. Tough night.
Yeah. Wow. That hawk was just laying in wait for just like weeks and weeks. Just like, yeah.
I mean, I think you have to own that one. That's on you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's okay, though.
Put a cross and
it's okay,
stuff
but
rabbits
yeah,
out.
You now, at the circle of life, you got to go get that hawk.
That's right.
You're going to have to go one-on-one, and you can't use any weaponry.
Yeah.
It's a one-on-one fight, you and the hawk.
That's right. The savage.
That's
you
got to
go Liam Neeson on that hawk. I saw what you've done, and I have a particular set of skills that
hawk,
I will find you,
hawk.
This hawk
has a particular set of skills. All right, it's 847. The Metro Milwaukee North Line through North Suburbs from Chicago to Fox Lake once ran like clockwork, now 15 to 30 minutes behind, the worst. Yeah, I wonder if that has to do with flooding, though. Is it because there's like a little bit of slowdown because of areas in the river? So if that's the case, I don't know, deal with it.
Yeah.
If it's not, it might not be. It might just be that they're mismanaged.
It's the trains.
Yeah, it's the train, yeah.
You're always going to get that.
I just, again, get angry. Where I get angry, just like with the barista argument, is I come from a generation that didn't have a little sign that said 6 minutes till the red line comes to the stop.
Mm-hmm.
You just did the neck crane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and we're hoping to see the lights.
Yep.
In the tunnel, you're like, is that coming northbound or south? Oh, south.
Yeah.
Darn it.
Yeah, we'd do that with the bus. We'd walk backwards down the street, waiting for the bus.
I can make it one more block, right?
Yeah. How far is the next stop?
Everyone's got these apps now.
Yeah.
Grandpa Kaufman is mad about that.
It's bad though when you get the CTA when. They close one side. The tracks are only running on one side of the track, I guess.
Yeah,
so it's like, 47 minutes until the next train because they have to wait for the three southbound ones to come through.
And then they're just sitting on that train by Armitage, just kind of waiting for 12 minutes. 224, the worst is seeing coming attractions for Stephen King's It. Scariest book ever, and waiting for the scary clown to be shown. And I screamed out like a little girl. Popcorn was thrown up in the air. Bonnie. Is that the one with the clown that is like terrorizing the neighborhood?
Yep, terrorizing all the kids.
I love that trailer. The trailer is so scary.
Yeah, it's great.
I get this thing with my son where I will go and we kind of like have fun going through the trailers that are on Comcast because they'll show you what trailers are out in the theater now so you can see Justice League and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what's this one? I made the mistake. I'm like, let's try this one. And he loved it. He loved, like, because he was just like, this is so scary. We got to show mom. And it was, like, towards the end, like, they have this, like, moment where the clown's like, wah! And
nice.
I was like, what?
I got that book when I was 10 years old from my mom.
He's 10, so there you go.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. 312-981-7200. The worst happened to me when I was younger. Had a girl over on a nice summer day. We were sitting outside when I noticed I had an unknown hole in my pants. And those unknown holes.
Yeah.
Back then, I didn't wear any underwear, and let's just say it was right there for her and anyone driving on the street to see. I've worn underwear ever since. Well, that's a strange story.
Yeah, it's a very strange story, but thank you for wearing underwear now.
Thank you.
In case.
Thank you. Thank you. Jerry's got another one here, 630. My now 88-year-old father belongs to a Fighting Pier Club in New Jersey. Okay. Pier extends out 200 feet. The worst is casting a heavy line with an expensive bloodworm as bait and having a seagull swoop down out of the sky and swallow said bait. You have to reel it in, get it on the deck, avoid its flapping wings, and nonstop biting attempts to try and retrieve your hook. What a pain in the beep. Yeah, that's that. This falls into the category of non-relatable. Yeah, I don't know how many people out there are like, you know what's the worst? When you hook a seagull.
Oh, yeah, man. Oh, that is the worst when you hook a seagull. And then you have to avoid it flapping wings and it's trying to bite you. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no. But there's that one guy that's sitting out there just like, yep.
Yeah, it's one person's like, I know what you mean, Jerry.
I know exactly what you mean.
779 says, the worst is when you order fried chicken and it tastes like shrimp because they share the oil slash grill.
I feel you. I feel you. <ya. laughs>
This is one that you can relate to?
I can relate to this one. Not the seagull in the bait, but shrimp, yeah. shrimp-flavored chicken. Yeah, that's it's not good. Not good. But, you know, it's kind of that. It's like, hey. Reese's peanut butter cups came along that way. Somebody was like, oh, you dipped your peanut butter in my chocolate. You dipped
so
your
at some point or another, we're going to have like a shrimp-flavored chicken.
Shrimp-flavored
chicken. Or a chicken-flavored shrimp.
Yep. Yep. Right.
224, the worst is getting a new cell phone and feeling like a dope trying to figure it out. Yeah, you know, I will say that that is definitely the case. But, I mean, they have figured it out. I don't know what kind of cell phone you're getting, but if you get an Apple phone, an iPhone in any form, it's like every step is telegraph to you. Hi. Yeah. Hi, Justin. Now here's what we're going to do. Are you ready for the next step? I mean, mm-hmm. It's like yeah. You just sit there and let the computer do its thing.
Yeah, it goes all through it. And I'm an iPhone person myself. And yeah. So I've never had a problem with each upgrade. It's just like, okay.
Where I get into trouble, and maybe if you were like me, is I automatically think I got it. So I'm like, I don't need this. Exit, exit, exit. I'll figure it out myself at a later date. Like, I get to a point where I don't want to, you can't tell me how to set up my phone. I'll set up my own phone. And then you're like, what? Where's the swipe on this thing? This phone is broken.
Someone help. Help with this.
Why is it telling me I got to upgrade? I just upgrade.
That is the worst. Yeah. The upgrades on the phones. I never do them. And then I go to take the phone in because I'm like, hey, something's not working right. My apps are shutting down. Oh, did you install the upgrade? Nah, I didn't.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
That's your job, computer.
Yeah, exactly. Just tell me while I'm asleep.
Exactly. 901 says, the worst is the obvious collusion between car manufacturers and windshield wiper fluid makers. Why else would they make the reservoir hole so small that you can never hit it when you're pouring your 2-gallon jug? It's like nailing a Cheerio in the toilet bowl when you're a 1-year-old, except harder. That's a very descriptive metaphor.
You started off great. And then once you got to Cheerios, it was just like, wait, what? Quit where you're ahead. No, that was good in the beginning.
414 has got a good one. Ready? Once while sitting in the Omaha airport waiting to board my flight home to Milwaukee, I overheard a guy talking on his cell phone to his mistress, whose name was Ginger, as the call devolved from the affectionate I'm thinking about you to an argument. The worst for him anyway was that our flight was delayed. I do like that. I'm thinking about you.
Yeah.
Well, no, I said I'm on my way home. Like an argument is to go from lovey talk to argument in the same public conversation. That's the worst.
Yeah, that is rude, man. Look, she's my wife. Yeah, she's picking me up from the airport, but I'll see you later on. I got to go home and unpack.
I told you I'll deal with my wife later.
Deal with her later. Look, I'm in Omaha in the airport. Do we really have to do this?
All right, here you go. 847. Ugh, these are the worst right here. The worst is when you're getting a cavity done and they inject the Novocaine in your gums and you can feel the needle moving around.
Oh, yeah.
You did it.
Yeah.
You did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You hurt us tonight.
Yeah.
You hurt us with that one tonight.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. I had braces as a kid and had to have like 4 like adult teeth removed. So I got a lot of shots at that time, and I remember every single one. So, yeah, that is the worst.
Oh, that is the worst. That's I know. Worst. I've told this story before, but I love my dentist, and he, at a certain point, they had a style in which they would deal with pain where they would try to distract you while you were getting the shot in your mouth. So that was part of their thing. That was on their website. They had some sort of pain management thing. Oh. So what the dental hygienist did, and the first time I ever went in there with a shot in the mouth, is she started rubbing my arm, like almost like in a caress kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And but no one said that was going to happen. And so the distraction is just out of the sort of unique moment where you're like, can I help you?
Right.
Like you're less about why she remembered. I'm like, what's happening here? Is this something? This isn't like you're just in your head. You're like, this is strange. And you're like, all done. What's all done? And they're like, that was, I'm like, I have no idea what's happening here, but I like it.
I like it a lot. hey, what? Okay. Yeah. No, that's nice.
Nope. 708 says the worst is that one person who always insists on sending you game requests on Facebook.
Oh yeah, like Farmville and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, those people are the worst. Are we still playing Farmville?
I know. Is Farmville still a thing?
That's still a thing. Mafia Wars was the other one.
All right. I'm glad that I read ahead on some of these. Some people just are the worst with their worsts. 312, the worst, coat hangers. So last century.
Yeah, I guess there haven't been any advancements in coat hanger technology.
Yeah, I would like it to be like sort of superhero technology where I just throw my clothes towards the closet and it like sticks to something. Yeah. Like a Batman kind of thing?
That would be nice.
Awesome, right?
Yeah.
Where it automatically straightens it?
Yeah. Hanging stuff is the worst.
It's so last century. You're right.
Yeah.
I need something where I just throw towards an area and it does it for me.
Yep. Just throw it in the closet. Right. And the closet hangs it up. And
folding stuff is also pretty bad, too.
Yeah. That's the worst.
And ironing.
All right. You know what's the worst? I'll give you a worst. Here's my worst. This is somewhat embarrassing personal. And it's not, I wanted to talk about it, but I don't know how to, because I'm sure everyone around me were like, is it really? But the worst is when I got a batch of clothes from the dry cleaner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Got them back to the house. Every shirt has a strange, moldy, sour sweat smell. Like a smell that's not my, it's not me. You know what I mean? Like, you know your own smell.
Right, yeah.
But I'm like, I spent the last 2 weeks going, like, smelling my collar of my shirt.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. And then my wife was like, you know, that happened to me not too long ago. It's almost like the way they package them maybe, and then where they put them in like in a dark room or something, and maybe they were wet when they were, you know. But it was a set of one set of like seven shirts.
That is strange.
Yeah, and it's particular. I've had certain, like, I've already dressed up. Like, I go in the bedroom and get dressed up, mm-hmm. and I go to the kitchen to, like, get my lunch together, and I will go back to the bedroom and change my shirt because I'm like, this does not smell right. I don't know what that is. If it's, a dry clean, if someone, I'm sure people can tell me, you know, on the air or just about what that is, but it's process. Something that just threw me off where I'm like, I spent money on these shirts. My wife was like, go take them back and say they smell. And I'm like, how do you do that?
You walk in, this isn't me. This isn't me.
I know my own smell.
I know my scent. This is not my scent.
No.
Who's been wearing my shirts here at the dry cleaner? Is it you? Is it you?
Who's been wearing the same checkered shirt that everybody has?
Right.
You saw my blue checkered shirt. And you're like, that's the 30th one of those I've seen today. But yeah, it's a weird kind of smell on it that I can't, and I realize it's not because the shirt's old or the shirt's dirty because mm-hmm. they're coming right off the package, but maybe it has something to do with the way they were pressed.
You got to take them back.
Yeah.
You have to.
But I just, I'm not even sure what, yeah. 773 says the cleaners probably had a moldy washer. I'm like, maybe that's possible.
I thought it was dry cleaning.
Yeah,
they get wet.
Right, yeah.
Did they not get wet, right?
I don't think so. They like spray them and just hang them up, iron them.
Yeah.
That is weird.
I don't know.
I had that happen with a dry towel today. It got it out of the closet to dry off, and it had a weird smell to it already. And I was like,
no, that's not, yeah, that towel's not going to be started. But all right, let's go. We'll go rapid fire here, and we're going to wrap this up.
All right.
The worst is when you get a gazillion emails saying, have you checked on so-and-so's latest updates? Yeah, that's like a 608. that's a Facebook thing, right? mm-hmm. because I said that on my spring break, I cut Facebook off of my phone and I did like a detox where I was just going to enjoy the vacation.
Nice.
And Facebook did everything it possibly could to remind me that I was a Facebook user. They mm-hmm. used email. They kept throwing emails to my Gmail. It must have been the way it's set up mm-hmm. that essentially was like, hey, Mars is talking about you. You should check it out. And then they're like, yeah. hey, it's been a while. And they would do everything they possibly could to remind you that people were having fun on Facebook and you should get back on there.
Yeah. And they will send your friends a message when you do get back on. It's like, hey, Justin hasn't posted in a while. Look who's back.
Look who's back.
And you're like, oh, let me see what Justin's been up to. And you're like, I was just on vacation.
I was just gone for, no one cares.
Did you notice until Facebook told
yeah.
you? I was like, no, I didn't.
815 says the worst is when you're getting a shot in the butt and the doctor slaps it before the shot. True story. Yeah, that is a weird.
That is.
Let's go ahead and whack. Yeah, now I got it right.
Stop
there.
Going to Dr. Dominatrix for all your shots.
All right, you ready to rock? We'll take a quick break here. We'll do a break. We'll come back. Mars and I will have the winners for the prizes here on The Worst. Stay with us. All right, wrapping up The Worst here before we get to Patty Vasquez, who's coming up next. Mars, Tim's in studio. Go see his show, Pimprov. Friday nights, 10:30 p.m. at the CIC Theater, 1422 West Irving Park Road. All right, tonight we're giving away a pair of weekend admission to the 20th annual Wizard World Comic Con Chicago. This August 24th through the 27th at Donald E. Stevens Convention Center. Celebrate the best in pop culture and meet your favorite stars from the movies, TV, and WWE to get autographs, photos, and VIP experiences. Go to wizardworld.com for tickets and more information. Also, we're giving away a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. We'll give away two of those. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. All right, the pizzas. Third place tonight, 817. People who continue to jog in place at a red light or stopped intersection. The worst, right?
The worst.
They're going to get a pizza for that observation. 815 is also going to get a pizza tonight. When you sand a difficult piece of furniture so long and so hard that your iPhone no longer recognizes your thumb scan. Oh, boy. That's the worst.
That's a good one.
That is. Yeah. They get a pizza. And number one, going to get the tickets to Wizard World. 708, the worst is guys who hang rubber scrotums off their truck bumpers.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Wow. Oh.
There you go. That observation is going to get you to the Comic-Con Wizard World at the Donald E. Stevens Center.
That's Mars, a jailable offense.
Yeah, right? I think they're plastic, but yeah, it could be jailable, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Mars, great to see you, buddy. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
All right, that was a good show tonight. Thanks for listening. Patty Vasquez coming up next. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio.